bankruptcy filings. She sought protection under Chapter 7, and by doing so risked the chance that the Chapter 7 trustee would attempt to sell her home. The trustee will be allowed an opportunity to try, and the debtor will not interfere with that effort. The motion will be granted. The proposed form of order submitted with the motion is acceptable, and the court will sign it. Mr. Gershong, if you would like to submit it as a received unsigned order, I will sign it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gershong. Thank you, Mr. Kaw. I hope you feel better.
I will. Thank you,
All right,
Your
thank
Honor.
You. Bye-bye. Mr. Kriegman returned. No. All right. Well, let's turn to the matters in the Northwest Territorial Mint case. All right, we have many people who have stepped up the council table, and I believe we have at least one person on the phone for this matter. So let's go around the horn. We'll start with Mr. Guerin's side of the table, see who is here who wants to appear, and if there's anyone sitting in back that wants to appear as well, I will call them up. Mr. Guerin, why don't you begin?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Michael Guerin, K&O Gates for the Chapter 11 trustee, Mark Calvert, who is with me this morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Mark Northrup, Miller, Nash, Graham & Dunn, counsel for the Unsecured Creditors Committee.
Good morning. Mr. Smith, we'll come to you. Start with you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Al Smith for the landlords, Robert and Connie Hoff.
Good morning, Your Honor. Rick Hyatt, representing Pan American Silver.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Catherine Seabright, representing the Boy Scouts of America.
All right. Good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Reagan Powers on behalf of Ross Hansen.
Good morning.
Michelle Harvey Kaplan on behalf of Gary Mark, Heidi Wasby, Mark, Numismatic.
Easy for you to say, yes. Numismatic, yeah. All right, thank you. And make sure that you pull a microphone towards you when you speak. So and sir, would you like to speak this morning?
Yes, I suppose so. My name is Joe Ilg, representing Crabcat Studios.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Ilg. All right. Is there anyone else in the courtroom that wants to be heard this morning? Yes, ma'am. Please come on up. And if you just like, you need to come up to a microphone and identify yourself. You can then sit back down. But we do need everyone to state their name for the record. And all this is being recorded for that reason. And then I'll turn to whoever's on the phone.
My name is Betty Carey, and I'm representing me.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Carey. Did I say it right? Carey? Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, can you spell that for us?
C-A-R-E-Y.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Carey. All right. And do we have anyone on the telephone?
Yes. Paula Pell.
Good morning, Ms.
Pell. Representing myself and also the unsecured creditors.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Pell. Is there anyone else on the phone? Not expecting anyone else. All right. So, Ms. Pell, let me just say, we're going to be hearing from a lot of folks for the foreseeable future. I don't want to forget you. I'm going to make a sticky note to not, but it's been happened that I get near the end and I've forgotten that someone's on the phone. So if you think I've forgotten you, don't be shy about speaking up, all right?
Thank you.
All right. There are a number of matters the court has before it today. Here's my list of things, and I believe there are four. We have the motion to reject the Kent lease. We have a notice of presentation of the order on the Hoff's motion for relief and stay. We have the trustee's motion for order authorizing an auction and sale, which I understand may be continued. And then fourth, it was filed ex parte, but we'll discuss it this morning. That's the trustee's motion to shorten time for hearing on a borrowing motion, a motion to approve bid procedures, and a breakup fee. So let's take them in that order. Let's first start with the motion to reject the Kent lease. And I don't believe anyone here is on behalf of the landlord, Mr. Guerin, you're approaching. This was a motion that you filed. There were no objections, but I had some questions. What is the trustee seeking to accomplish with this motion?
I think a couple things, Your Honor. Relieve the trustee from affirmative performance going forward on the, this is a post-petition lease, so we understand there's an administrative claim that will arise from this. So the trustee intends to relieve the state from affirmative obligations to perform under the lease and to allow the landlord to go forward and mitigate their damages and relet the space. I do perceive, when I look back at the order and I saw you raising issues, I did perceive a question about how to deal with the claims issues. And I think we should talk about, I think the trustee's intention here, we will be filing a motion to convert the case. And so I will suggest that we put that on the calendar for the March 9 calendar, and we'll note that out, put it on for the March 9 calendar, and that whatever claims the landlord would file would be due after, or we could use the bar date that's set under the Chapter 7 after conversion, or some other date that you might want to set. But I think the claims issue is probably something that needs to be adjusted in the form of the order. I don't know if you have other questions, but.
Well, I wasn't quite sure because, I mean, as you said, this is a post-petition lease, and while your motion said pursuant to 365A, you're seeking to reject it, you can't. It's not subject to 365. It wasn't an unexpired lease of the debtor. It's a post-petition lease entered into by the trustee. So I didn't understand this notion of rejection back to the date that you filed the motion. I don't, because it's an administrative expense claim, the fact that you're in or out doesn't matter. As you said, the landlord does have a duty to mitigate, but other than that, being in or out or the day that it's effective, I'm not sure I understand why that matters. And if you're asking for permission to breach, I mean, is that what you're asking for? Because again, you can't reject the lease. There's no large R rejection because this is not a lease that's governed by 365.
Well, I haven't looked at this for a while, but I think we looked at it when we considered what to do with post-petition leases, and I do believe there's authority for that a post-petition lease or an assumed lease can be rejected.
In Ray Danton Russell, Inc., 853 F. Second 700, Ninth Circuit, 1988, Section 365A of the Code governing executory contracts and unexpired leases is inapplicable to leases executed post-petition. Ninth Circuit authority, right on point. So I that's why I didn't understand this motion.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, it's not something I was aware of. I apologize to the court. Well, I didn't. I think we looked at and seen indications in Collier's that post-petition leases could be rejected, and perhaps we should research it more thoroughly. So,
it's not a post, but it's not an unexpired lease of the debtor. I mean, the debtor didn't enter into it. In any event. That's why I didn't understand why you were seeking rejection and seeking to impose a deadline for filing a proof of claim, because a proof of claim is also for pre-petition claims. You're not arguing that they're okay, because the proof of claim is for pre-petition claims. It says right on the if you're looking to set a deadline for them to file an administrative expense claim, not really inclined to do that either. There are a lot of administrative claimants, and I'm not putting deadlines on anybody else. So I recognize this is relatively small amount in the scheme of things. It's $5,000 a month, right? Was that right?
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So, and it expires at the end of June, I think. So,
correct.
You know, so it's real money to a lot of folks, but in the scheme of things, it's a relatively small amount. But I'm not going to grant the motion because I don't think that it really seeks any relief that I can grant, other than perhaps imposing a deadline to filing a request for administrative expense claim, which I'm not going to do. So the court will enter an order denying the motion. So that takes care of the first one. Then the next issue is the relief from stay motion order, and I saw that you, both you and Mr. Smith, had filed statements And it looks like you've agreed on a form of order, which is good, and the form of order looks acceptable to the court. So the only issue then is the budget. I knew this might be a little bit of a challenge, but it's obviously needs to be done if the Hoffs are getting a lien on all assets. So I know that based upon the filings yesterday, that there may be some change in how the trustee is approaching the budget. So let me hear from you, Mr. Guerin, then I'll hear from you, Mr. Smith, on where we are on that.
Right, Your Honor. I think things are fluid in terms of how these assets are going to be disposed of, and I think you've seen we filed yesterday an indication that we actually reached agreement yesterday on a sale of the majority of the equipment. So that's a very recent development, and that's caused us then to modify the budget going forward. We have been communicating with Mr. Smith during the course of the last couple of weeks. We produced the budget to him, the initial budget to him on January 31, as you had required us to do. We've had a couple of iterations of that going back and forth, and we've had conversations with him about issues that the Hoffs may have with respect to the budget. We filed last night. I have not really had a chance to discuss in detail with Mr. Smith since we filed it late in the afternoon. I did talk to him yesterday before we had filed the revised budget. But my understanding is that what the Hoffs, the issues that the Hoffs have raised are really threefold. They are, number one, they have an issue about Mr. Wagner and whether the estate should retain Mr. Wagner and continue to pay him a salary. Whether there should be some ongoing operations where the trustee continues to deliver product going forward. And then lastly, there's this flux in what's going on, what the budget really is supposed to be, which I think we have now resolved.
Okay.
So I think the issue with Mr. Wagner, I think Mr. Wagner is somebody who is indispensable to the bank, to the estate. Mr. Wagner has all of the institutional knowledge that the trustee needs to rely on moving forward. He has knowledge of the asset base. He has knowledge of all the dies. He has knowledge of the customers. He's working with prospective purchasers in depth to communicate with them about the value of the assets and where the assets are located and what could be sold and what couldn't be sold, those kinds of things. He's also the guy who has the computer systems knowledge. He was the CIO of the company. He's an essential part of the liquidation process, the trustee's ongoing liquidation effort. So the trustee doesn't feel like he can do without Mr. Wagner. Mr. Wagner resides up here in Washington, but he has traveled fairly frequently to Dayton as that's necessary for whatever business purposes. So I think that Mr. Wagner, those issues from the trustee's perspective, he really can't do without Mr. Wagner going forward. Now, it is a short-term duration for Mr. Wagner's services. When we get the assets liquidated, I don't think Mr. Wagner is going to need to stay on the payroll at his full level going forward.
Okay.
Now, on the issue about continuing operations,
right.
What the trustee's done since he closed the plant is he's retained a skeleton staff down in Dayton, and he has pushed out some unfulfilled orders, some work in progress, and that has benefited the bank, the estate. If you look at the cash collateral budget, I think you'll see about $175,000 of accounts receivable that are coming due in the month of March. Those are on account of the orders that the trustee pushed out in the month of January. Those are receivables that are owed to this estate. There's profit in those. Those have been carefully analyzed. The trustee's not proceeding with to produce a product and deliver it unless he knows that there's going to be profit in doing that. So, continuing those very streamlined, very limited operations makes sense. It is a benefit to the bankruptcy estate, and the trustee believes they should be allowed to continue to do that for a very limited period of time.
And let me make sure you're only completing work in progress. You're not taking on new orders, or correct?
Yeah. That is correct. Okay. There's one exception to that. There was a silver order for some silver bullets we could push out very quickly that had a very strong margin on it. And I did just take that order. There are also orders coming from China, and those orders from China take a time to get here. They're customer orders that need to be packaged and shipped. So there's a great margin in those too.
All right, so your intention and desire is to continue to take a few orders here and there only if they are...
I don't need any new orders. It's just work in progress, and now to complete the stuff that's being done.
Okay, all right, other than the silver bullets, everything is already in process. All right. Okay, thank you. And the third item was then, I guess, we're in flux.
We are in flux.
There's no doubt. There are a lot of balls in the air that the trustee's trying to juggle, I recognize. I don't know if it makes sense to talk about that now or in connection with the sale motion, but...
I don't think there's any more to say about it in relation to the budget.
Okay.
So I think there's a lot to talk about in connection with the sale motion.
Right, okay.
But in relation to the budget, I don't think there's any more to say about that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Karen. I'll hear from Mr. Smith, really on the issue of Mr. Wagner and, well, anything else that you'd like to add. I think those are really the two issues.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's correct, but I don't think that they can be addressed outside the context of the third issue, which is this flux issue. We did receive, and I absolutely agree with Mr. Guerin's characterization. He's been very good about keeping me posted telephonically and sent the budget over, the last iteration over to me before he filed it with the court. I mean, you know, a few minutes before, but before. And he is keeping us up to date. But this has been a very, very difficult period in terms of trying to keep track of what's going on. Projects, and Mr. Guerin will get to this, I'm sure, but, you know, a sale was on, a sale was off, an auction was on, an auction was off. And we've now got a budget that, frankly, came out yesterday afternoon. My clients are in the air as we speak. I haven't had a chance to talk to them about it. And while I get the fact that Mr. Guerin, Mr. Calvert has to operate here the next couple weeks until we have these ongoing, whatever happens, auction, sale, whatever, I do think what really makes sense, Your Honor, is to approve a budget for a couple weeks, subject to revisiting when my clients have a chance to actually look at it in light of what's actually going on in the case and not in light of what was anticipated 3 weeks ago or so when the budget was first, a week and a half ago when the budget was first prepared. And so while the form of order that we submitted, Mr. Guerin and I agreed to, it has the line and approved by the Hoffs, which was somewhat optimistic at the time of preparation of the order. And I would actually suggest that we strike that language and then put in a clause that says, until February such and such, the trustee is authorized to use cash in accordance with the budget that was approved, that was submitted yesterday. Hopefully, during that period, Mr. Calvert and the Hoffs can speak directly or through Mr. Guerin and I in terms of figuring out what exactly Mr. Wagner does. The last time I've had a chance to communicate with my clients, their understanding was that he's really high-priced for a company that is in liquidation and isn't supposed to be operating. We've gotten a little more detail in terms of what's going on here this morning. Mr. Guerin has explained much of that to me before, too. But we really do think that maybe in a couple weeks, operations will be over and we'll have clarity as to who all really is there doing what, which is the point of the budget.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Guerin, what do you think of the notion of the change to the order that Mr. Smith suggested, and that you go ahead with this budget for 2 weeks? Because we're going to be seeing each other, my guess is, in a couple of weeks.
I'm hoping that's true, Your Honor.
Yes. So I think that's the case. So does that make sense?
Or? Well, I mean, I have a hard time with, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time.
And that's costly, I know.
And we're, you know, revising additional budgets. And, you know, so anyway, I do think it becomes difficult if we're taking this one bite at a time.
Let me say this. Mr. Smith, I understand your client's concern, but I'm not inclined to micromanage the budget. Mr. Wagner has been with the company for years. The trustees states he needs Mr. Wagner. I don't want to be penny wise and pound foolish, so I'm not going to overrule the trustee's judgment on a key person. So I'm going to overrule any objection on that basis. I think it does make sense to make this temporary only because there are things moving in place. But let's make it for 30 days, and so the Hoffs aren't going to approve it. but we're going to change paragraph five of the order to say, attached here to is Exhibit A is a budget prepared by the trustee, the budget. And then Mr. Smith, you had suggested that the trustee is authorized to use the cash in estate, blah, 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 set forth in the budget. And then at the end, we put until a further hearing. I mean, we could just set this for another hearing. That would be, we could set it for the 9th of March. All right. And maybe in the interim, you've reached agreement. I'm hopeful that we will know where this case is at more substantially by then. But that's going to be the ruling of the court. So if the two of you can work on the language, but we're going to, it's going to be good for a month, and then we'll revisit it if you two haven't agreed. All right, Mr. Guerin and Mr. Smith.
I think that's fine, Your Honor. I'd just like to make clear, for there are a lot of players here, that even though the order says only through March 9th, if in fact we are able to reach agreement on an ongoing budget after that, we can simply submit it and not have to go through another hearing and submission to all the other players here today and all that. It's just between the two of us.
I agree. So if the two of you reach agreement, you can just submit it as an agreed order. I'm going to look for this order from, I guess, you, Mr. Smith, on this. It's not urgent. It's not like a DIP financing. But if, you know, call us when you send it up, and we can get our eyes on it and get it signed. Okay, so that will take care of the relief from stay motion. Here's what I'd like to do, though. I want to take the Davis matter, because I don't want to keep Mr. Symes and Mr. Kriegman here for another hour. Everyone can sit where they are. I'm just going to ask Mr. Symes and Mr. Kriegman to come forward on the Davis matter. And if you can both stand at the podium. You guys won't hit each other, I know. All right. This is on the Davis matter, and this is the trustee's motion to approve the sale. And when we last were here, Mr. Symes, I'd asked you if you had objections to the sale motion, and I heard no but. So tell me what your position is.
Well, the position is, excuse me, the debtor still opposes the motion.
All right.
However, you know, he wants to retain the home, you know, basically. He's lived there for 20 years. He has a daughter that's finishing high school. He feels that he can raise the funds if necessary and just would like the opportunity to do so even before, you know, the sale closes. The proposed date, I believe, was the 28th. So if you are inclined to grant the motion, he would like a chance to contribute to the estate in order to retain his home.
Well, I understand your client's desire to stay in the home. That's been clear throughout. But today is the day for me to approve the sale. If you wanted to make a deal with the trustee approaching Mr. Kriegman before today and offering more, I mean, there's no reason for him to do the same deal. You've got to do something better. You know, Mr. Kriegman, I don't know what your position is. I mean, have you had any negotiations with Mr. Symes or his clients in this regard?
I'm hearing it as you are, Your Honor, but the problem is, as I told Mr. Symes before the hearing, is that...
Can you come up to the microphone?
As I told Mr. Symes before the hearing, first of all, we have an obligation to the buyer at this point, and we don't want to renege and breach the agreement. I think that would expose the trustee to some potential claim. And then also, as the court noted, we need more. And it's kind of like that saying, you know, too late, no, too little, too late.
I was going to
And that's really where we're at.
I agree. I'm sorry, Mr. Symes. I know that your clients have really wanted to maintain this house. They have worked very hard. You have worked very hard on behalf of your clients, worked very admirably on behalf of your clients. But I am going to grant the motion. This has been going on for a long time, and the court finds that there are grounds to approve the sale. Section 363 F2 allows the trustee to sell property of the estate free and clear of liens if the entity consents. Here, Shell Point, the first mortgage holder, has consented to the sale and to receipt of less than the full amount of its secured claim. I was going to go into the Jolan analysis with regards to the junior lien holders, but the trustee has negotiated resolutions with them, so they are no longer secured claims, so we no longer need to address the junior lien holders. Then that takes us to whether or not KVN Corp requirements have been met, which is a showing that the trustee has fulfilled his or her basic duties, that the agreement benefits the estate and will provide a meaningful distribution to creditors, and that the terms of the agreement are fully disclosed. Here, the duty has met his duties by promptly administering this asset. This is not a situation where the trustee has sat on his hands, quite the opposite. There's been a lot going on, a lot of it prompted by the conduct of the debtors, allegations of interference, which I never ruled on, but clearly there was conduct by the debtor, including going to the bank at the last minute to try to negotiate a loan mod, which has caused, if there's any delay, it's really been due to the conduct of the debtors. Further, the trustee has disclosed all terms of the agreement. Debtor's contention, which can only be described as desperate, that all the material terms of the purchase and sale agreement regarding compensation to the sellers and broker's agents haven't allegedly been revealed or inconsistent is not accurate, but it is meaningless given that the court approves the compensation to be paid. Finally, the carve out of approximately $60,000 to pay approximately $166,000 in unsecured claims will yield a meaningful distribution to unsecured creditors. Therefore, all the objections are overruled and the motion will be granted. Mr. Creedman, if you'd like to submit your order, you probably are going to ask that the, well, is the 14-day stay waived?
Yes, Your Honor.
I usually don't do it when I've got objections.
Right.
Your closing date is February 28th.
Right.
And we are at the 9th. Well, I mean, you can get everything ready. I'm not going to waive the stay. I'm going to give the Davises a chance to appeal. And so I won't waive the stay. All right. So if you could submit your order, but take that provision out.
All right. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Creedman. Thank you, Mr. Symes. All right. I appreciate everyone's indulgence, because I know this matter is going to go on for a while. So let's go back to the Northwest Territorial Mint matter. That takes us to the third item on my list, which I think is the one that's going to take the bulk of our time, and that is the trustee's motion for approval of the sale. Now, I did note, and Mr. Guerin, you noted in your presentation this morning, you now have two sales, two asset purchase agreements for the majority of the assets in this case. I guess one question will be, what's not subject to those two APAs? The second issue is, what do you want to do with the motion today? And the third issue is, how do we resolve a lot of the issues that have been raised for today? Continuing this motion doesn't address them. And I don't want to just kick the can down the road. So my plan is, if you could address all those, I'm going to try not to interrupt anybody. I'm going to let everybody talk. I'm going to let you talk. Then I'll hear from Mr. Northrup if he'd like to speak. Then I'll go around the horn. And then I'll come to you, Ms. Pell, and Mr. Ilg, you're included. I'll hear from all of you on this motion. And then I will ask my questions. So, Mr. Guerin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, to cut to the chase, I think we do want to continue this motion, and I think that what we have in mind is maybe continuing it to March 9. And the purpose of that would be, we do have, as you've seen, these two purchase and sale agreements that are out there for a significant component of the assets of the estate, not all of them, but a significant portion of the assets. And so what we'd like to do is move forward with that sale process, and that we envision bid procedures. We'd like to get it. That's why we filed our motion for the bid procedures and motion for shortened time. We're trying to get those teed up, and we would like to have the sale motion heard on that March 9 calendar. So The idea would be if those sales are approved, then we would not be going forward with the auction. But if those sales aren't approved, I think we still need to reserve the ability to conduct the auction because we still are under pressure to get those assets liquidated and moved out of the Hoff facility before June 30. So that's what I think we want to do with the auction. I agree with the court on the issue about teeing up these substantive issues, whatever substantive issues there may be. I think there's really only one body of substantive issues that we need to address, but I will go into some detail about that. What's in and what's out? We've got two purchase and sale agreements that we have now filed with the court, and I think they are pretty clear in terms of what is being sold under those two purchase and sale agreements. The larger by dollar amount and by volume is the industrial assets Maynard's deal. That deal really is all of the, it's the majority of the debtor's machinery and equipment, some autos and trucks, related tooling, attachments, parts, accessories and manuals, and the office furniture that's located in Dayton and Green Bay. That's what's included in that. And there are pictures of the equipment that are attached to the purchase and sale agreement. It actually took us a fair amount of time to go through and to specifically identify everything that was there and be clear with the buyer as to what they were buying. So I think there's a significant detail. People ought to be able to figure out exactly what's being sold by looking at the asset purchase agreement and the attachment to that. That deal was a $1.95 million purchase price. It has a DIP feature that we've filed a motion to approve a DIP on it. The DIP intends that the deposit, the $195,000 deposit that I expect to receive today, been promised to me today by the purchaser, that we will be able to use that as a debtor in possession finance error incurring credit, and we can use that to fund the ongoing expenses of the liquidation, including, frankly, Your Honor, the majority of that is going to the Hoffs, right? The majority of that is rent. So I think about $140,000 of the $195,000 is really going to pay the current occupancy costs that we've discussed in prior hearings, and the principal benefit of that DIP really goes to the landlord. But there are other expenses that the trustee needs to service with that DIP, and so we would be coming forward with a motion to approve the debtor in possession financing. Asset purchase agreement also contemplates that the buyer will have an opportunity post-approval for a 90-day period to liquidate those assets and either conduct an auction of its own, if they so choose, or sell it in parts to various parties and have them have an opportunity to remove those assets over a 90-day period. So we still have pressure in terms of the timing of having that agreement approved because we still have the 90-day lag post-approval. And we need to retain occupancy in the Dayton premises to get those assets moved out of there and liquid and sold by the buyer. The second sale is the Metalcraft sale. And the Metalcraft sale is the Medallic art name, website, phone numbers, Medallic customer list, Medallic archives, Medallic company-owned dies, certain tools and woodworking equipment, and then three specific items of machinery that are described by a serial number in the purchase and sale agreement. The price there is $700,000. I am holding in my trust account now $100,000 deposit from that that potential purchaser. And we would intend to move forward with that, and we're going to suggest a March 9 hearing date to approve that sale. So what those are about, those are the Medallic dies. Now, we're kind of breaking the dies into two components. What had traditionally been used by the Medallic side of the business and the rest, the Northwest Territorial Mint dies, we're not proposing at this point to sell the Northwest Territorial Mint dies. And that's important because many of the objections that have been filed, who owns these dies are really filed by Northwest Territorial Mint customers. And we are not yet proposing to sell those. They're not in the present sale, but we are working. The trustee is still working hard on trying to liquidate those assets as well. And we would be intending to come forward with additional proposals to sell those assets in the Northwest Territory Mint side of the asset package.
Okay, so the first APA is not including the Mint, Northwest Territory Mint dies.
Correct.
Okay, all right, thank
correct.
You.
Now, there are parties who have objected. I think there are four parties that I'm aware of that have objected, and we've been creating a log of everybody that we know that has called, written to us, or filed an objection with the court, that has expressed an ownership interest in these dyes. And I don't think I have the current version of it with me today. I have a version of it, but we're doing our very best to catalog all of those requests and complaints from people about the ownership of the dyes. And our intention then would be to go back and to address those. And I do have a proposal for the court on how we would go forward and address the whatever disputes there might be about ownership of the dyes. But I believe there are four parties that I am aware of thus far that have dyes that are part of the medallic package that would be sold to Metalcraft. And I can tell you who those are. It's Herf Jones. Some of these, there's only one of them I think has filed an objection. Herf Jones, the Beckham Foundation, that's B-E-C-K-H-A-M. Brook Green Gardens, which I think is Ms. Kaplan's client, and the University of Pacific. And I believe only the Brook Green Gardens party is the only one that's filed an objection thus far with the court, but we're aware of these other assertions of ownership interests of these other three parties to medallic dyes. So the trustee is continuing to negotiate other sales. There's various other packages of assets that people are expressing interest in. He's got a couple of outstanding purchase offers. I saw one yesterday that was circulated for about $400,000 for a package of assets. He's negotiating with another party about a package of assets in the same range. I think what's left really is stored inventory, all the Northwest Territorial Mint side of the dye equation and Northwest Territorial Mint assets. And the range of value there is somewhere between $400,000 and $900,000 to $1 million. So let's call it $400,000 to $1 million in residual value that the trustee is still working on liquidating. The trustee also needs to dispose of old records in the facility. And I want to mention that, Your Honor, because we will be filing a motion for permission to go and dispose of a large volume of old records, because we do need to start cleaning this facility out, and the trustee only has a limited period during which he's got the labor that's necessary to go dispose of these records. And so we'll file a motion for authority to shed some of those old records. So I think there's two substantive issues that I think have been raised that need to be resolved before we can move forward with the sale motions. And I think those really are around the ownership of the dyes. And secondly, I suppose the issue about MALP, and whether MALP has an ownership interest in this. And I guess I would say, to Your Honor, I do not think there really is a legitimate issue about MALP's ownership of any of these assets. And I think we've presented to you evidence that makes it very clear that those assets were transferred from MALP to MAC LLC sometime in 2009. And I can canvass through all of that, but I think the thrust of the status of it right now is there's no party that's come forward with any evidence to the contrary. There have been a couple of parties that have suggested they have doubts or that they think these assets may not have been transferred, and that's Mr. Hansen and Hoffs, but neither of them has submitted any evidence to support those contentions. And I don't think there is any such evidence, and I don't think any discovery is going to lead to any such evidence in the future. So I think the court could dispose of that issue now. I think we've presented the evidence that the Hansen and Bressler declarations, which both stated that MAC LLC inherited, succeeded, or obtained all right, title, and interest to the purchase assets. We showed you that MAC LLC filed a lawsuit in which it stated that it was the successor in interest amount, and it now owned all of the assets originally purchased from the Dalek Art Company Limited. And we presented the information that showed that the MAC LLC was charging equipment rental charges and leasing charges from MAC LLC to the Mint on account of those assets. We also presented to you in our most recent submissions the tax preparer's documents, and that shows the tax returns, which confirm that MALP had no assets, filed a final tax return in 2009, in which it indicated it had no assets left at the end of 2009. and the MAC LLC tax returns, which reflect that the assets that were acquired from the Hoffs are on the MAC LLC books. And there's depreciation schedules that are there. They match up to the purchase and sale agreement. There is no question that from 2009 forward, MAC LLC filed its tax returns and indicated that it owned those assets. There's no evidence to the contrary, and MALP has not stepped forward to file any objection to raise its ownership interest, and that's because it can't. It cannot provide any evidence to support its ownership of those assets. These suggestions that we should have evidentiary hearings or we should have further delay to resolve that issue, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that it is a waste of our time. And it would only be done to delay and obstruct the trustees' ability to go forward and liquidate the assets. So I think we should move past that issue, and I would request that the court actually rule on that issue today based on the evidence that you. I will go back and circle back to Mr. Hansen's been in the courtroom here. He's here today. He was here 2 weeks ago when these issues were being addressed. He's filed a response personally without any supporting declaration. He's aware, as a representative of MALP, he is aware of that this issue is squarely being presented to the court, that the trustee takes the position these assets all belong to the bankruptcy estate and not to MALP. And MALP has not appeared and presented any argument to the contrary. So I think that's extremely important, and for those reasons, I think you should rule on that question. To the Dye issue, which I think is more complicated, and I think we do need a process, and we do need to sort out and give people an opportunity to come in and present their arguments as to why they think they own these dyes. The trustee believes the dyes all belong to the company, and he's done a significant amount of work in investigating. He's consulted with a number of employees, former employees. I actually reached out to Mr. Smith, and I asked him to give me some feedback from his Hoff, who had been the former owner of the Medallic side, of the dyes from the Medallic side. And Mr. Smith has informed me that Ms. Hoff has substantiated that the policy of Medallic when she owned the company was that the dyes all belonged to Medallic, belonged to the company. So we can't get a declaration from Ms. Hoff presently. She's traveling. We could submit that at a later date, but I have a number of other employees. I've submitted to you the declaration of Mr. Wagner that I think lays out the company policy, gives you the company website, which has a clear expression, which states that the dyes are owned by the mint, owned by the company, and not by the, but they are being retained, that they are owned by the mint. So I do think we need a process for how to deal with that, a briefing schedule, a date by which you can make a determination on those, on the ownership of the dyes. I think it has to be done before we conduct the auction or move forward with the sale process on the metalcraft side of things. It's not relevant to the industrial assets sale. From my perspective, there are no dyes in the industrial assets sale, but it is relevant to the metalcraft sale. So I think we'd be prepared to move forward quickly, Your Honor. And if you want it on the regular calendar, I think the next calendar I think you have is the 23rd, and we could try to arrange a briefing schedule. I think that what we would do is give notice to everyone that we know that has expressed an ownership in the dyes, and we tell them that there's a deadline by which you must submit your package of evidence that supports your arguments that you have an ownership interest in these dyes, and then the trustee would respond to that. And then we could have a hearing so that the court could rule on the ownership of the dyes on that issue. I'd be prepared to, if you want to do it on the 23rd, Your Honor, I think we'd have to perhaps have everyone submit their submissions by next Friday, and then we could have responses due on the following Wednesday. I'd be prepared to do that. If you want to press it back a little bit, perhaps give us a special setting date, we could have a more relaxed schedule for those submissions.
How many, and I said I wasn't going to interrupt, just procedurally, how many people are we talking about, and do you have a way to contact all of them?
I have a way, and that's a good question, Ron. I have a way to contact everyone who has reached out to us and raised the issue. I think we have letters, emails, those kinds of things from people.
What about those that haven't? Those are the ones I'm concerned about, because I guess, can you identify all folks who may assert an ownership interest.
No, you can't, Your Honor. I mean, I think it is impossible. There are thousands of dais. The dais go back...
Greater than 4,000, if I recall.
I don't know if it's that far.
I read the website, too. So, greater than 4,000, so there's a lot of dais.
Right. So, and there's, they go back 100 years. They go back years and years and years. And so some of these customers may not even be in existence anymore. And there are dais in China. So there's really no way to go make a complete, list of everybody that has a dais has been used by the men over the course of 100 years. So for me, I think it has to be narrowed down to those people who have stepped up and raised their hand.
But if you didn't tell them that you're going to sell their dais, how can they step up? I mean, it's a due process problem.
Well, I follow that, Your Honor. I guess I...
Because Ms. Kaplan's got several clients, and I don't know how her clients found out, and Mr. Ilg is here, he found out, but you didn't give notice to all potential customers, so they can't step up. How do we deal with that? And there may not be a good answer, and it's an imperfect situation, I realize, but I don't think we can just say we're going to limit it to only people that have found out about the motion and have raised an objection. I don't think that's fair.
I will say, Your Honor, I think I'll point out that we were careful in the way we expressed things in the Metalcraft purchase and sale agreement. And what we are selling is the company-owned dais. So I think we should get a determination from the court that the company policy that they're, these dais are owned by the company. Whether some party could come later and challenge that post-sale, post-approval of the sale, based on lack of notice, I think that would be a risk that the buyer would take. I think that we still should get an order that says that the court made a determination that based on the policies, the dais belong to the company, and then those parties that didn't have notice, I think they would have their due process arguments, and they'd be able to come back and seek recourse and go back to the buyer and raise their hand and say, wait a second, we still think this dais belonged to us, notwithstanding what the court's ruling was regarding the general body of dais. So, that may be one way to work around it.
Okay, and I'm open to suggestions. I mean, I'm not telling you something that you haven't thought of. I mean, this clearly is a challenge, and yeah, some of these dais are 100 years old. The owner's gone, so as a practical matter, it belongs to the mint. Whether legally or not, you have it, and there's no one that's going to challenge it. But there's going to be a universe of people that don't know about the motion that are around that might assert an interest. And that's how we need to figure out how to deal with those folks.
I understand. I think it's a bit of a quandary, Your Honor. I mean, another aspect of this is it turns out there are some of these guys that don't belong to the bankruptcy estate. Administering those and returning them to people, and it is a
that begs the question. Then what? What do you do?
Right, so, right, so right. I mean, one, and I think it's an important point. One benefit, one significant benefit of transferring these dais to a buyer is that buyer then is retained, they're maintained, they're in a location where people can still come and gain access to them. If they do have legitimate claims to ownership, they can still reach out to that buyer. That buyer, and I think this is one of Mr. Ild's issues that he has raised, the buyer that we are seeking to sell the Medallic assets to, not Mr. Ild, Mr. Ild's Northwest Territory Mint guy, so I'm clear about that. We're not selling his
but to the, when you find a buyer for
find
the
a buyer,
mint dies.
That buyer it can actually produce the product that Mr. Ild is looking to produce. So there is a benefit to him, right? He has somebody he can go to actually substitute in for what Northwest Territorial Mint has been doing for him. So there are benefits to these customers from concluding the sale. If we don't transfer these dais to somebody who's going to be a repository for them, the consequence of that is going to be drastic. They're going to have to be destroyed. They're going to go to the wind. There really will not be any way for them to gain access to those dais. So I think there's enough benefit there to folks that have not received notice about the disposition of these dais. I think they would want them to be in the custody of somebody who's going to take care of them moving forward. So then the last thing I think I'll say, Your Honors, I'll talk about, and this kind of bleeds into, I think, the last issue on your schedule, which is the motion to shorten time. I think we would want to talk about moving forward the schedule on approval of the DIP, approval of bid procedures for these other sales, auction scheduling, and approval of a breakup fee. So I would like to do that on the 23rd, on the court's calendar on the 23rd. That's why we filed a motion to shorten time yesterday.
You want the hearing on the bid procedures, et cetera, on the 23rd, or the?
I would ask the court to schedule that for the 23rd so that we can conduct an auction before the hearing on the 9th, which we put the sale hearings on the 9th of March. That would be the intention. So.
All right. So to approve the two APAs on the 9th?
Correct.
All right. Well, I don't have any. I will approve that. We can do that right now. Why don't we take your order? And if you have that, this is on your motion to shorten time.
I do.
All right. Well, I can just tell you the date. So you're looking for a hearing on the bid procedures motion for February 23 at 9:30 a.m.
That's correct.
All right. So we'll do that. That's 9:30 a.m. Any responses? So today is the 9th. I'm going to give folks a little bit more time. Let's have responses. The 19th's a holiday, right? Yeah, so I'm going to, folks can respond by the 20th. And your replies will be due by the 22nd. And we'll say 5 p.m. for all, everything. So any responses to the bid procedure motion will be due on February 20 by 5 p.m. And any replies filed by the trustee and support shall be due by February 22 by 5 p.m. Paragraph 4 is, when shall you provide notice? Well, today is the 9th, right? So you really need to get it out by the 12th. 2/12, is that going to be a problem?
I don't think so.
In terms of notice, you don't need to, on this motion, you don't need to notice the entire matrix, just the...
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I think that's actually what we propose in this paragraph here. I don't want to be vague.
Yeah, good. There it is. Paragraph 6. Yes, you asked for that. All right, and I that's acceptable.
I think it's in paragraph 4, Your Honor. It's we're talking about.
Oh, case management. That's well. It's also 4 and 6. Right. So yes, 4 and 6. And then paragraph 5, in terms of the date for the hearing to approve the APA. Yes, March 9 at 9:30 is acceptable.
Okay,
so we'll look for that order. Again, call me when you send it up. I will be around today to sign it. Probably the sooner the better. So if you can get someone to make all those changes and get them up to me for signature so you can get it out the door.
We'll do.
All right. Thank you.
So those are my comments, unless you have any questions.
So I do have a lot of questions, but one thing I want you to address that I don't know if you did, and this is complicated, the intellectual property aspect of it.
Right.
And some of that's tied in with the dyes, and I know that's the concern of a number of folks, Boy Scouts, I think Mr. Hyatt's client, certainly Ms. Carmody's clients. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Ms. Kaplan's clients. So, so can you address that?
I think I can, Your Honor. I meant to cover that, but I don't think we are transferring intellectual property. So, I think that's the issue, one of the issues I think we have to resolve in the briefing schedule. But I mean, I've been communicating to Mr. Hyatt, and I think to Ms. Kaplan as well. We are not transferring any licenses. We are not transferring any intellectual property. If you look at the Metalcraft APA, it does not assume and assign any intellectual property. It is only the physical dyes that we are selling. And I do think those are distinct. I think, that some of the objections I'm seeing are people are trying to blend and take the position that the dye itself has intellectual property embedded into it that is impossible to separate from the physical aspect of the dye. I don't think that's true. And I think what we're selling is we're selling the physical dye, which may have copyrighted, may have materials on it that if they were used by the buyer, that could violate someone's intellectual property rights, copyright, for example. I think the buyer knows that. The buyer's, aware that it's going to have to go get a license from someone to go print those dyes. But the purpose, from the buyer's perspective, the purpose of taking the dyes is so they can have that conversation with the former customer, right? So that it can talk about whether it can use the dye and whether it can provide service to that customer. It's an aspect of goodwill, frankly. It is a significant aspect of the goodwill of the company. These dyes are something that are used to promote the business of the company, have been used that way for many years, and would be used by a prospective purchaser. That's why they have value. So we're not proposing to transfer the intellectual property. I think we've made that clear in our filings. I think I've made it clear in my conversations with the with counsel for the owners of the folks that are objected, and I think they are distinct from the physical dyes that we are trying to sell.
All right, thank you, Mr. Guerin. I will have a number of questions, but I want to hear from everybody, and then I'll come back to you. Mr. Northrup, is there anything that you'd like to say?
Your Honor, Mark Northrup for the committee. I can be very, very brief. As you can imagine, I receive, in addition to communications with committee members, I receive multiple calls from many, many unsecured creditors across the northern hemisphere, basically. And as you can imagine, they're all extremely disappointed and disheartened by the way this case is turning out. At the beginning, I think we all recognized that the only way there would ever be a meaningful recovery for unsecured creditors would be if the operating business managed to survive in some reorganized form and was able to generate some kind of value and dividends into the future. That hasn't worked out. There is no reorganization, and now we're obviously facing a liquidation. I think the further reality of the motions before you now is that there's no evidence whatsoever that the value of estate assets that exist is sufficient to generate any kind of dividend to general unsecured creditors. And largely for that reason, the committee did not file a formal response to first the auction motion and now these multiple Section 363 follow-on motions, because really the committee doesn't have an economic dog in this fight. One person in a bit of gallows humor described this as participating in the liquidation of the estate is sort of like participating in the drafting of your own death warrant. The trustee has a fiduciary duty to maximize value for the benefit of the estate, and we certainly expect that he will honor that obligation.
All right, thank you, Mr. Northrup. I'll turn to you next, Mr. Smith.
So, thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus first just on the big picture from our perspective, which is we want the space back. We want these things to happen, whatever they are going to be, and we want them to happen quickly. We understand, as Mr. Northrup noted, the trustee's got a duty to do all those things, and we understand the deals are where they are. I therefore do not want to object in any way to the program, the process of going forward on this schedule. We want that to happen. I do want to just note for the record, so there's no surprise, I personally have a couple things coming up, and you will be getting letters about telephonic appearances at some of these upcoming things if the dates are as ordered, and that's just the way it is. I do want to note one thing, because my clients' names were somewhat taken in vain. In terms of the dyes, it is, in fact, our clients' position and understanding when they were running the company that the dyes were owned by the company, but that did not mean that they had the right to go and use the dyes and print things and market things and everything to the extent that other people's intellectual property was involved in the dyes. And I hope that some of the objecting parties take some comfort from that I don't think has ever been the position of the Mint under any, or Mint or Medallic under any of these ownerships, that it is a marketing tool. Customers either had to come back to you and pay you for new stuff, or they got to pay somebody else to make a new die. And that's the marketing issue. And it's just, that's the way the business works. I do want to address briefly, Your Honor, Mr. Guerin's comments about MALP. We do, it's his burden to show it's property of the estate. Wednesday afternoon, we got the data dump with Mr. Noyes, Mr. New's declaration. And, you know, I understand there's a lot of evidence there. I do not have contrary evidence. I do think the statute of frauds is something that does come into play when you have a transfer of assets in violation of a third party's rights. It is not too much to ask to say, show us some evidence that that actually happened at that time and somebody told us about it at that time, if you're going to have it effective against us at that time, which is what the trustee's request is. Having said that, my client is not going to be able to come up with any evidence other than what you already have, which is the lack of any indication whatsoever that there was actually a transfer, as opposed to what these guys may have been doing internally as between themselves. That was the data dump from Wednesday. Other than that, Your Honor, other than the MALP issue, I do think, Your Honor, we do want to see the trustee go forward with whatever he's going to do in whatever iteration of this process turns out to be happening, so that they can, in fact, finish it off and get out of the space and the Haas would like it back.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. And while you didn't say this, I know your client is asserting, to the extent the Medallic assets are part of the estate and are sold, your client's asserting a security interest. But I think everyone seems to agree that the assets can be sold because it's disputed. There's no doubt it's disputed, and it can be sold as long as monies are reserved to pay your client's potential secured claim. The sale can go forward.
To the extent it is a lien on my clients,
right.
Yes, those are disputed and those can be sold free and clear, notwithstanding the dispute. We did supply some briefing that to the extent it's an ownership dispute, you can't do that.
I understand the difference, yes. All right, thank you. We'll just go in order. Mr. Hyatt, you're next.
And it's still morning, Your Honor.
It is still morning. We've got a little while until otherwise. Good.
I had, excuse me, two issues. The first one deals with the attachment of the proceeds, the sale to the secured claims. It's my understanding that
it's the same issue we
agrees
just
to that. So if that's included in the order, then that part of my objection is resolved.
Okay, and that's the same issue with Mr. Smith's client, so absolutely. I guess I will want to ask both of you, what do you think the number is that needs to be reserved, because that might be in dispute, and we'll need to resolve it today, but we'll need to resolve it at some point. Your client's claim, I think, is a little more straightforward in that, in terms of the amount.
It's straightforward from the point of view that we have a list that we claim is secured. It's a little bit complicated because we're not sure what's there, what isn't there.
Right.
You know, Mr. Geer and I have been talking about it, and he's indicated to me what they've identified that would be included on that list, and I accept that.
Well, there's the collateral issue and whether your claim is secured, but in terms of the amount to be reserved, that's going to be the issue. And my understanding is that the amount of the claim is not in dispute. Is that right?
You mean the value?
No,
the collateral.
The amount that your client is owed, just in terms of the dollar amount, whether or not it's secured or unsecured.
I don't think that's disputed.
I don't think we focused on the dollar number of the entire claim.
It's over $1 million, and the collateral is worth massively less than that.
Okay, but I'm just saying that what, all right, we're going to need to figure out what needs to be reserved.
If I could, Your Honor,
if
I can assist with it. We have had discussions, Mr. Hyatt and I both, about identifying the collateral that's left there, and that's what's going to drive this, is the value of the collateral, not the amount of the claim.
All right, because the collateral is less than the amount of the claim. Okay, all right.
I can tell you, it's in the range, from my perspective, it's in the range of $60,000 to $80,000, based on what we've seen. We have one number that we've not been able to pin down yet. There's like 7 items of equipment that are left from the time that this security interest was originally granted.
All right.
Many, many years ago. We've identified 6 of those, and we have values for 6 of them. We don't have the value for the 7th. So I'm working on that. I'm going to try to work out a deal with Mr. Hyatt on an allowed secured claim. That would be the intention.
Or the amount that you would set aside from the sale, because I know you're disputing the existence, the validity of the lien. Maybe not?
We are.
Okay,
we are.
All right.
And
so
we just got to... Some settlement is what we were talking about.
Okay.
Of those issues with an allowed secured claim. So that's been the conversation, and I can tell you it's certainly under $100,000.
All right. At one point, I think I saw the number $700,000 may have been the value of the equipment, but that may have been a long time ago.
I think that was the agreement that they were supposed to maintain equipment in the amount of $700,000, but that obviously didn't happen.
That's a long time ago. All right. Okay, I didn't mean to get sidetracked on that, but that's also going to be an issue for Mr. Smith's clients as well. So Mr. Hyatt, let's come back to your client's issues.
The next issue deals with what we've been calling the dies, and rather than saying molds and stamps and tooling and I'll just refer to it as dies.
Well, I'm going to hear from everyone, and then I'll come to you, and then I'll look at you. But it relates to what he's saying.
Yes, it is.
Mr. Hyatt, would you like to take a look at what Mr. Ilg has? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, pardon me.
This doesn't involve my client's position, Your Honor.
Oh, all right. So, Mr. Ilg, I'll let you speak.
Yes,
and you
sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So, Mr. Hyatt, all right.
I'm not sure where we are now. I understand from Mr. Geerin that my client's dies are considered Northwest Territorial Mint dies and are not part of the Medallic dies. And I also understand, based on his statement, that the dies are not included with the property that's going to be sold on Northwest Territorial Mint. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not sure even if there's something, is there still a pending motion sell free and clear through an auction?
Well, as of today, there's no motion because we're continuing the motion, but I just want to get ahead of these issues because at some point, the Northwest Territorial Mint dies are going to be sold, and everybody's here today.
Right.
So I
appreciate that, Your Honor. You know, my clients lost over $1 million of consigned bullion. This is an administratively insolvent case, except for its secured claim. It's not going to get anything back. So what it's trying to do now is, without spending too much money, protect itself with its secured claim, obviously, but also protect itself on the dies that it has. The proposal of the trustee, whether it is in the future or otherwise, is to sell the dies free and clear of liens, interests, and encumbrances. Well, the dies embody my client's intellectual property, and I submitted a supplemental declaration with pictures, and I hope the court had an opportunity to look at those pictures, because what the bars and the coins are Pan Am, Pan American, with my client's logo, and that's all over. And then, you know, in small print, you know, in the corner at the bottom, it says Northwest Territorial Mint. That's it. That's the coins that these dies are producing. So I don't think there's any dispute by the trustee that my client owns the trademarks, copyrights, the logos, everything that's embodied on those dies that produce the coins. We talk about who owns the die. Well, my client owns, without dispute, the trademarks, copyrights, all the intellectual property that is its, that is incorporated onto these dies. So if that's the case, when you sell this die to somebody else, what are they going to do with it? Well, they're going to print coins. Otherwise, it's only good for a paperweight or a doorstop. It's a hunk of metal. And to say that it's owned by them and they can sell it free and clear of my client's interests are the intellectual property rights that are embodied in that, I think is wrong. I don't think the code allows it. And so I think they're wrong that they can just sell it outright. My client's different than a lot of these other people that don't have agreements. We have an agreement. There was a license that was required to use our intellectual property. That license was terminated. The way our clients, you know, the parties agreed at the end of that period to protect my client's intellectual property was we were to get those dies back. That didn't happen. So the only way that I can see that the trustee can sell these assets free and clear is to delete my client's intellectual property rights that are embodied in these stamps, or the dies. And this is not uncommon. When trustees have auction sales of, say, a computer, you know, computers have information on them. There might be a copy of Excel. There might be a copy of Microsoft Word. And those are all license-protected documents that you can't just sell free and clear. And, you know, the Murphy Company wipes those clean before it sells it at an auction. That's exactly the situation we've got here. To say that you can sell it free and clear of our interest, but everybody knows that they can't really use it without a license from us, I just, you know, if you buy it at an auction, it's yours and you can use it. And there's no way that we can prevent resale of it. And if this is used on the open market, it can be transferred. People could use it to produce inferior items. And it has our logo and stuff on it. We're the ones that are going to be harmed by improper use of the intellectual property. So I don't think that the trustee has the right to sell it free and clear of our interest, because we own that intellectual property. And if it was to be sold, at the very least, we'd be entitled to adequate protection. And the only adequate protection I can think of is deleting the information from the coins, or the dies themselves that would produce the coins.
But that's not possible, is it? I mean, other than...
Well, I mean, you'd have to filing do something off. To... Right. Oh, well, yeah, it's then probably possible. It seems ridiculous.
Right.
But that's the only way that I think my client can be protected, or give us the dies back.
Okay. I got it. Thank you, Mr. Hyatt.
You bet.
Your Honor, does it make sense to address the amount now? I'm happy either way.
Sure. If that's not going to, I don't need to resolve it today, but I want to get everything out so everyone knows what we're talking about, so come the next hearing. So what's your client's position on the amount that would need to be reserved?
We have no idea.
Okay.
We don't know what our collateral is worth, but right. We don't think that the trustee should be spending any money other than what's in the budget, including receipts from any of these deals, until the very end when he will have everything. We will at least know the results of the sales, and, Your Honor, we still have this super priority claim and our secured landlord-type claim, and so I just don't think we're going to have to address value until at the end of the day when we need a whole lot more. I don't think we have to reserve anything.
In light of your other protections that the court has granted you in relief from stay?
I said that wrong, yes.
Yeah, okay.
We should reserve everything and figure it all out at once as opposed to trying to put a number on it now or even later.
Okay, yes. So in other words, all the proceeds from the sale of any assets, I call them medallic assets, but more specifically, they're assets that were sold by your clients in 2009. That's the universe of assets that could be subject to your client's security interest. Now, I'm not talking about the lien that you're getting in the relief from state, but your security interest. That's a different lien.
Understood.
Okay. Okay. Understood. All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. All right. Ms. Seabright, you're here on behalf of the Boy Scouts of America. All right. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. I don't have a lot to add to what Mr. Hyatt already had to say. BSA, likewise, is not prepared to concede at this point that the company owns.
Hold on. Someone's phone is by a mic. Someone's phone is by a mic. Or unless Ms. Pell, something's happening with the phone line. There we go. Ah, phone, iPad. I remember when Judge Steiner didn't like calculators in the courtroom because it was an electronic device. Anyway, things have changed. I'm sorry, Ms. Seabright, if you'd like to proceed.
I was saying that BSA likewise is not prepared to concede at this point that the company owns BSA's dyes. That being said, we are open to discussions with the trustee about what to do with them. In our case, Northwest Mint Territorial Mint's license agreement with BSA has expired, so there is nothing to assign at this point. If the dyes are ultimately sold to a buyer, BSA's primary concern is that the buyer is required to enter into a new licensing agreement with BSA to protect BSA's congressionally created trademark.
All right, thank you. Let me ask you a question, though. One of the other objections that you raised was that you believe that there may be within the debtor's inventory items that have the Boy Scouts logo on it. Is that just a suspicion, or is that the case? And I'll ask Mr. Guerin and Mr. Calvert if they know the answer to that. But
I don't actually know the question to that, okay. Your Honor.
We do know, Your Honor.
Okay, what's the answer?
I could. There is some inventory that has the Boy Scouts logo on it, and I've talked to Ms. Seabright's colleague, Mr. Schickich, about this.
Okay.
I told him we'd give him a list, and we will produce that, and we actually have discussed the liquidation of that those materials from Boy Scouts may want to buy that stuff. So
okay, all right. So everyone's there are some items, but people have that on the radar screen to get that resolved. Okay,
right. And those that inventory is not the subject of either of the two pending purchase and sale agreements.
All right, good. Okay, thank you. That's all I have. Thanks, Ms. Seabright.
Thank
you. All right, Mr. Powers, you're up.
Morning, Your Honor. Reagan Powers on behalf of Mr. Hansen.
Good morning.
I wanted to address a couple of the issues, and I'll hit the mouth issue head on at first. To step back a bit, because when this came up, a couple of hearings ago, you raised the issue, and I went back and looked at the pleadings in the adversary, and in our objection, Mr. Guerin says we don't submit any evidence, but we referred the court to the dispute that took place in the fall of 2016 over whether the assets that are now at issue were property of Northwest Territorial Mint, or whether the assets of MAC LLC should be consolidated with the assets of Northwest Territorial Mint. And when you read through those pleadings, it is clear that the trustee's position was that MAC never obtained title to those assets. And they pointed repeatedly to the fact that there was no evidence in the record of a transfer to MAC. And you referred to Mr. Hansen's declaration the last time we were here, and I read it, and I read what it says, and I think I agree with your characterization that corporations don't inherit assets. Now, it is certainly true, and I didn't go through the massive pleadings that the trustees' counsel included in their reply the other night. It is certainly true that Mr. Hansen testified that it was his intent that the assets would be held by MAC, but there is no evidence of an actual transfer. And so you have this issue of, do the assets still belong to MAC technically? And the way that plays out is that if they do, then the Hoffs' security interest attaches to those assets, and the Hoffs have a security interest in any proceeds of any sale of those assets to pay the full amount of their breach of lease claim, not just the super priority claim that you granted last week. So it is a significant issue, and it is also true that while the court can sell assets where the lien in the assets is disputed, you do have to determine ownership before the estate can sell assets, because of course the estate can't sell assets to which it does not have title. And you know, we have the trustee until, you know, this issue came up, taking the position in the adversary proceeding that MAC didn't have title to the assets. So, you know, today it's convenient for them to take that position, but it is clearly an inconsistent position. So
let me say that I don't think you weren't involved in the adversary, but I don't think that's an accurate characterization. The trustee's position was it went from MALP to MAC to Mint.
I don't.
They're nodding their heads, and that's. I was there, so so that was their position. I don't think they were saying it went from Mr. Hansen to the Mint. I don't think that was ever the position. They were saying that it didn't belong to MAC because it belonged to the Mint, not because MALP didn't transfer it to MAC. I don't think they were objecting to that.
The pleadings say what they say, but I think their position was that there was, and what you were really talking about was the lease.
Yeah, but
there was
no
transfer of the lease from MAC to MAC.
They moved for substantive consolidation with MAC.
Right.
It only makes sense that MAC must own the stuff. That's their position, is that either MAC owned it or the Mint owned it, but they were never saying that MAC owned it. That was the purpose of substantive consolidation.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree, Your Honor. But the point is, the argument they made was that it went from Mr. Hansen to MALP. There was no evidence of a transfer, and really what they were mostly arguing about was the lease. There was no evidence of a transfer from MALP to MAC, and their main position was that it really belonged to the Mint.
Well, their position was it was either MAC or the Mint. And if it was MAC, then there should be substantive consolidation. That was their position. It wasn't that they were never arguing that it was MALPS or the Mints. I'm fairly confident that that is what was litigated in the case. The problem is no one named MALP in the lawsuit. That's
right.
The problem. MALP wasn't a party to the lawsuit. And that's what left the gap in the chain of title, and that's what I've been talking about, that the substantive consolidation didn't address the chain of title problem. But so since I've interrupted you, I'm going to continue on. Where's MALP? Where is MALP? Why aren't they here?
So MALP was administratively dissolved,
okay,
which means Mr. Hansen speaks for MALP.
Right.
Right? So Mr. Hansen is here, and MALP is in the process of being reinstated. I believe it's being reinstated today, but I can't say that. And so, to be clear, Your Honor, I have not said that I would say anything on behalf of MALP until it's reinstated, because that would be inappropriate. So MALP will either exist now or will exist as a valid Nevada entity today or tomorrow or next week, whenever the papers go through.
And while you don't represent MALP, so answer if you can, but to your knowledge, if you can say, is MALP intending to assert ownership interest of these items? I assume that's the whole raison d'etre for getting reinstated.
Well, I think the point, a couple points for Mr. Hansen and on behalf of MALP. You know, the litigation, the substantive consolidation litigation went on for a long time, and MAC finally threw in the towel, in part because of what we now know, which was the business was headed down last spring. But Mr. Hansen has, and I'll come to this second issue in a moment, Mr. Hansen has an interest, unlike what is happening here with this liquidation. Mr. Hansen has an interest in saving the business and operating the business, or some portion of it. And Mr. Hansen also has the issue with the Hoffs and the lease, and so what Mr. Hansen proposed several weeks ago to the trustee was that he would, with assistance from a gentleman named Mr. Parrish and an entity that belongs to Mr. Parrish, they would propose to pay $1 million cash for the assets of the estate and assume the lease. And that assumption of the lease, I think, results in a savings in administrative expenses of probably over $1 million to this estate. And so that when you put Mr. Hansen's offer together with, and compare it to what the trustee is now talking about, and when you start taking off all the deducts for the trustee's expenses, the super priority claim for the Hoffs, the administrative expense claim that the Hoffs are going to have, it's they're really pretty close, and the trustee has not even been willing to entertain a discussion with Mr. Hansen. The trustee won't even let Mr. Hansen inspect the premises to see what equipment is there. I mean, the trustee won't even talk to us. And so part of this is that if you're going to sell assets, and I think you're going to hear some more about this from other people involved in these claims over the dies. If you're going to sell assets, you have to know what you're selling. And until yesterday, none of the trustees' papers provided any information to anybody other than whoever they were negotiating with about the assets that they had to sell. And so here we are, you know, they were trying to rush through the auction without any list of assets, and now we have a couple of asset purchase agreements with some information about the assets. But I think you do have to resolve one way or the other the MALP issue, or the trustee has to deal with it. And I think in terms of wrapping up this estate quickly and getting it done, the offer that Mr. Hansen proposed is a lot more straightforward and would have resolved this. I mean, we would be done by now. And instead, we're looking at several more months of this estate remaining open and running up a lot of fees. And so part of the second thing I'd like to talk about is if the trustee is going to go forward with, if the court's going to allow the trustee to go forward with the sale process, and you've already set a hearing date on the bid procedures, I'd like the court to indicate to the trustee that everybody who wants to participate in this auction, including Mr. Hansen, should be entitled to inspect the assets and get the information that is being provided to all bidders.
Anything further?
The only thing I would add, Your Honor, is that I do think there, you know, the court has raised the issue of ownership of the MALP assets and would not allow the trustee to grant the security interest to the Hoffs that the trustee had agreed to grant to the Hoffs back last spring. And if what the trustee is now saying is, well, really, the assets did belong to MAC, then I think the Hoffs should have gotten a security interest. And if you're gonna say that MAC owned the assets after all, even though there was no decision about that, then I think you have to go back and revisit
the security interest issue, because that was the agreement that the trustee made.
Why is your client interested in that?
Because, well, my client's on the hook, for one thing. Although my client doesn't have assets, he is on the hook on that lease still. He still gets notices of default when the trustee defaults on the lease. So if the trustee is not going to perform the lease that he insisted on assuming, then the Hoffs should have the benefit of what they negotiated for it as protection of Mr. Hansen.
Right. Well, I think we reserve that. I mean, that was the whole discussion I had with Mr. Smith, is that we recognize that if they're assets of the estate, his client's asserting a lien on it, and that's going to be reserved for a later day.
Well, but to be clear, the issue there is there are a couple of security interests involved.
Right.
So
right.
If the assets were the assets of Malp,
right,
then their UCC filing carries through. If they were the assets of Mac, the UCC financing statement was brought current in the spring of 2016.
Well, right, and I'm going to decide that's the issue to be decided after the sale. Whatever lien the Hoffs have will attach to those proceeds, but it's disputed that the lien is valid due to lapsing of UCC filings and the like. You did not answer my question, which is Malp going to assert an ownership interest in the Medallica?
I believe that it will once it is reconstituted.
So, and how do you propose that that be resolved?
Well, I think the rule is that you have to have an adversary proceeding, which I don't particularly want to see. I think what you could do is set a hearing on it between now and March 9, make Mr. Guerin file all his papers at one time so that we don't get the Thursday or Wednesday night reply with 300 pages of new exhibits. And we'll file our papers. Mr. Smith can file his papers, and you can decide.
So what papers do you have that I haven't seen? Because there were a lot of stuff filed in the adversary proceeding.
I don't know that I have a lot that you haven't seen, but I think there is some merit to teeing up the issue in a way that was not teed up in the adversary proceeding. Because you really, as you pointed out earlier, they were really sort of arguing about different things.
I think that's right. And that has been, you know, I wrote that in the decision that I issued last fall, that there was that challenge. I know Mr. Guerin's going to remind you, and you've already touched on it, your client was adamantly insisting that Medallic owned all these assets, filed a proof of claim, filed a lawsuit, filed declarations.
And you denied summary judgment.
I didn't rule, but your client said all that under oath. Mr. Bucknell filed the proof of claim under penalty of perjury that Medallic is entitled to lease payments because it owned all of those assets. So I've got evidence that the estate owns those assets, don't I?
Well, what you have is if because that was the belief, but if in fact Medallic Art didn't own the assets because of some technical issue, then it didn't own the assets, and that's so. There's no perjury or anything like that involved, and it was very clear in the pleadings that there was no document transferring title to the assets to MAC or to Northwest Territorial Mint, for that matter.
All right, thank you, Mr. Powers. I appreciate your answering my questions. Let's see. Ms. Kaplan, you're next, and then I'll come to you, Mr. Ilg, and then to you, Ms. Pell. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm hanging on.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Kaplan.
Nice to finally appear in your court after almost 2 years. Nothing that the trustee filed in reply changed any of my clients' positions that they still own the physical dies. The trustee presented a declaration of Mr. Paul Wagner, and it seems that they're trying to tout him as an industry expert about what the standard in the industry is. Mr. Wagner's LinkedIn profile has him as a turnaround specialist, which is not an expert in the metallic art or the minting industry. He worked for the company, or worked for, and I apologize, I think he worked for the Northwest Territorial Mint for 5 years. which grants him some experience with that company. But the trustee's position is completely inconsistent with their marketing materials that they have been sending out post-petition. We are holding your dies. We're ready. And that is completely inconsistent with their position now saying that we own the dies. And they're also the expert opinions that we provided in the declarations of Mr. Martinescu, Gary Marks, Heidi Waswit, and Scott Miller, who set forth all of their credentials. And they truly are experts in the industry, and they all believe that they own the actual dies. The trustee is saying that in 2009, we purchased these dies, and they were subject to the purchase agreement. Okay, you might have purchased whatever the seller had, and I believe the seller is Mr. Smith's client. But if they didn't actually own the dies, and I don't believe that notice was given to all of the potential customers that, like, hey, your dies are going to be sold, step forward, and you're given the opportunity to make ownership claims. And so, per Mr. Guerin's suggestion, let's just kick this can further down the road. You know, now we're 8-9 years later, and the trustee is trying to sell these assets yet again, and now clients are, our customers are coming forward saying, hey, wait a second, those dies are mine. And I do not understand or know specifically how my clients found out about this motion. I do understand that at Green Gardens, we filed a late objection. They didn't contact me until Tuesday morning after my late filing Monday evening of our objections. And going on here, and I apologize, we are very late to the party, so trying to,
all right.
I'm having a very hard time keeping track of, you know, who's on first, Malp, Metallic, and I understand Metalcraft is a proposed buyer, but it's very confusing.
Those of us who have been with the case for a couple of years now are used to all this shorthand. Mm-hmm. It's not fair for those that are late to the party, but there have been a number of related entities. Mm-hmm. So in any event.
So in that respect, if I'm botching,
I'll fill in the blanks for you.
Thank you. So it came to my attention today that the Metalcraft APA is really only trying to sell, I believe my only client's interest there is Burke Green Gardens, but I can't verify any of that. My question is, what about the other three entities that you listed, and I didn't get their names? Were they provided notice of the sale? Did they know that their dies or their alleged dies are being sold, or that their IP and interests are in jeopardy? And again, I guess by default, if those three are with the being sold to the Metalcraft, what about the rest of the dies? And I'm assuming, and that may be wrong, that the rest of my client's dies are with the debtor, Northwest Territorial Mint. And I just skimmed the filing yesterday about the sale, and the one to the liquidation company, are all of the dies going to be transferred there? Because they were talking about dies made in the last 20 years. Well, as we've all acknowledged, this company is over 100 years old, and they've started making dies in 1903. What about the rest of those dies? Are those part of the dies that are Northwest Territorial Mint's dies, or are they going to be sold to the liquidation company, and then they are going to have 90 days to liquidate these assets, which then dovetails right into Mr. Hyatt's Mr. Powers' IP arguments that you have absolutely no control. You have buyers who may or may not adhere to the intellectual property owner's rights, and they have zero quality control over if these images are being used. And I think that in this case, the intellectual property is, they're saying it's separate from the actual physical die, but I think they're inextricably combined. The clients provided the artwork for these dies. They provided, in some cases, the plasters to be made, and they paid, per our evidence supported to attached to Mr. Mark's declaration, $700 aside for these dies. And that point, how can you use these dyes if it's the work, I think that's a work for hire. If the work is provided to the mint and the mint then makes this, I still think the creator of the dye, the sculptor, they have the intellectual property rights and they own the artwork that is just being minted for the dye. So again, I think that this is going back to the who actually owns these. Mr. Ilk, is it Mr. Ilk? Handed me an email, and it looks like it was from yesterday, from a Marty Colwell. And my understanding is that he was a salesperson for Northwest Territorial Mint or one of the other companies.
Is for the mint, and there's an email in the record from Mr. Colwell, not dated yesterday, but dated recently.
This one is saying that, may I read the into the record, or do you not?
Sure, sure. Go ahead and read it. What's the date on the email?
It's February 8th at 5:25 p.m. I don't know what time zone. For most of my 17 years at Northwest Territorial Mint, the policy was that the customers paid for the coining dyes, as such, they owned them. That changed approximately 3 years ago when Northwest Territorial Mint policy changed to match the Modelic Art policy, which was that the coining dyes would not be returned to customers for any reason. Since it's been many years, since you've had any coining dyes produced, I'm sure you will have. I would have told you that the dyes were or are your property. So the salesperson for the debtor.
And let me just say that that's not technically in the record, but what is in the record is there's an email from Mr. Colwell to Mr. Ilg stating, I can confirm that you paid for your coining dyes. If it were up to me, they would be returned to you promptly. The court is considering that.
Yeah, okay, so that, I mean, and this was Mr. Ilg.
That's a longer version of what's already in the record.
Same thing. And I do want to kind of dovetail onto Ms. Sebring that the Boy Scouts concern. My clients have heard rumors that in each of the boxes that contain the customer's mints or dyes, not the mints, that the mint kept a coin from each production run. And if those rumors are true, and you guys, I think that's an easy thing to resolve, I think those coins can't be sold. The customers paid for those coins. I also believe that there are dyes and plasters from the mints, and those were provided by the customers. So we get to the issue of notice, and I don't know how the court can address the notice. I think if you're trying to have a hearing on the 23rd, you still have, if you have 305,000 dyes, just a wag here. Maybe
304,000, but who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? Yeah. It's some change. You know, maybe that distills down to 75,000 customers, and we have the four that have come to me. One of them, obviously, late filed submission, and then we have several individuals in the courtroom or on the phone who are, I believe, asserting ownership rights in these dyes. I think that any discussion.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
We're having.
Yeah, it's the key then.
Over here, it's the red and that green.
Yeah, it's going red and green.
They're replacing all of those, and we were all locked out of the courtroom as of 8:30 this morning. But
fabulous.
That at least got that fixed. But all right, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's
Ms.
okay.
Kaplan.
I don't know how we address this, but having a hearing on shortened time on February 23rd, there's no way to get notice to this huge, ostensibly a very large population of customers who may or may not want to assert their rights, their ownership rights in these dyes, and having the customers have to figure out, oh, the dyes were now sold by Northwest Territorial Mint, who's the new owner, and then I need to go contact the new co or buyer to, one, find my dyes because I want to have them reprinted, or two, I want my dyes back, and then they're going to have a fight with the buyer who's going to say, well, no, I have a court order that says I purchased these free and clear of all liens, and so I think the real issue here is the due process of all of these customers that I am troubled by the court if the court were to enter an order without their due process being heard and given the right to notice in a hearing to have their interests heard. And I guess if you have any questions for me about my client's positions or...
No, you laid them out very clearly, and I think you have touched on some of the other issues. I've raised the due process concern as well. I know the trustee and council is aware of it. We just need to figure out how to deal with it. All right, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kaplan. What we're going to do is I'm going to hear from you, Mr. Ilg. Then I'm going to hear from you, Ms. Pell. Then we're going to take a short recess, 10 minutes or so. I'm going to come back. I have questions for Mr. Guerin. I'm going to give him a chance to respond to what he's heard. And then the court is going to issue some ruling and guidance going forward. All right, Mr. Ilg?
Yes.
Good morning still. Good morning, please. You're very welcome.
This is my very first appearance in court since I was a juvenile delinquent.
well, welcome.
Eons
Hopefully this
ago.
Will go better, however that went.
let's see. Brief, you have my bio and package.
I do have what you filed, and I have reviewed it. Thank you.
Basically, there are two aspects very well covered by Ms. Seabright and Mr. Hyatt. Better than I can articulate them, they relate to the intellectual property. There is a different take on this, however, and pardon me for speaking in the first person, but I worked 15 years, invested 10,000 hours in templates, and it all evolved down to December 2017, where we submitted to Holland America, Costco's, Nordstrom's, the Smithsonian Institute, the Suquamish, and a long list. So the little business was on the cusp, on the threshold, when this tsunami struck. Personally, professionally, we're broke, and our lost opportunity costs and lost income, and having to abort these overtures and packages and pitches that we had made with some pretty established outfits. This was to be kind of the crown jewel of 15 years of work. Until November and our late November, December. So we've had to interrupt everything, all our business activities to address the concerns about ownership of the dyes. And equally important, how shall we explain to, I guess you could call them subsidiaries, like Aristocoin Watches, who incorporate our medallions into wood products, watches, and so forth and so on. So we've had these evolving relationships with partners who use as a component piece the Northwest Territorial Mint produced material, and all of this is very bewildering. And frankly, our business is more than disrupted; it's destroyed.
I'm sorry, sir.
I'm not quite sure where to go with this. Whether we have any, whether we can get any compensation for the disruption or for the loss of income or loss of anticipated income or anything of that nature?
Well, sir, I can't give you legal advice on what to do in terms of pursuing any claims you may have.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that today your position is that at the very least you want the dyes back. No, you want the dyes that were created for your...
For which, as a matter of fact, we paid a premium. But as you can see, the policy of Northwest Territorial Mint was one for years and years, and then Medallic's policy with respect to ownership of dyes
And I saw the email that from Mr. Marty Colwell, who you were dealing with for a number of years.
Right, and Marty knows the entire landscape, the whole ecosystem of that operation.
Okay.
From the perspective of a national salesperson.
All right. Mr. Illig, I'm sorry for how things have gone. Today, the issue before me is how do we address the ownership of the dye issue? And I'm going to try to figure out a way to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure how. I'm still going to hear from some more folks this morning,
mm-hmm.
soon be this afternoon. But
I see. Well, given one contingency or scenario where Metalcraft takes possession of them, there's still the question of intellectual property and.
Right.
And all that.
And that's a very valid concern that you've mm-hmm. raised. Ms. Seabright, Ms. Kaplan, Mr. Hyatt have all raised, and I'm going to definitely have to address that, or at least set a timeline for getting a final decision on that issue. It's a very valid point. So
mm-hmm.
I'm going to hear again back from Mr. Baroness, mm-hmm. And then we'll go from there.
Well, we certainly like to have those dyes at our shop.
Understood. Okay.
And then we can negotiate either with we can negotiate and discuss matters with Metalcraft, but
or
we
whatever.
Want physical possession of those things.
All right, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your coming in and presenting your position. Actually, I forgot, Ms. Carey, you're still here. I didn't mean to ignore you. Would you like to be heard? Would you like to say something? Well, why don't you come up, and Ms. Pell, then I will turn to you at the end, all right?
Yes, thank you.
All right, Ms. Carey, if you'd like to come forward to the podium, please. Good morning.
No, good morning. I've had some conversations with Mr. Calvert, and what's happened is I haven't been able to view the inventory when the bankruptcy first started. So my metals that I had stored, I believe Mr. Calvert very likely sold them, and because I can't see the inventory, or he hasn't shown me the inventory. He says the FBI might have the inventory or has the inventory, but I'd like to see it with him, or I would like for him to give it to me so I know exactly what inventory that he's looking at, and he would have known what he sold, or maybe just kept. I don't know. I don't know what the fate of my metals has been. I just had a very hard time dealing with Mr. Calvert.
Well, I understand your concerns. There are, you know, there are unfortunately over 3,000 people that have claims that many of them are asserting that their metal is there. And there's a lot of metal that's missing. And so I'm going to ask Mr. Guerin and Mr. Calvert to respond directly to what you've stated this morning. I can't speak to you in particular, but I do know the trustee has spent significant time trying to identify the metals and the items that were being stored and return those to those people. But there are lots and lots of people whose metals were not identifiable or just not there. And he can't have all 3,000 people. He cannot have all 3,000 creditors coming onto the facilities looking for their items, because they're just, the records were not very good.
Well, I know that my items were there.
Well, but everyone says their items were there.
My items are very identifiable.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let Mr. Calvert and Mr. Guerin respond to what you've said directly, but a lot of people believe their items were there, and they were not.
About seeing the inventory.
Right, but there were no inventory records. It's part of the problem. The records were very poorly kept at the company, and so, I can't speak to yours in particular. I do know the trustee made a lot of effort to try to identify whose metal belonged to who, and I can't answer your question today whether your metal was sold or not. I certainly believe the trustee did not intend to sell your metals.
The photographs.
Okay.
There would have been inventory photographs of palladium and gold,
right,
and silver, and that kind of thing.
Right. I'm terribly sorry. I don't have an answer to your question today. Again, I'll let Mr. Guerin, who's trustee's counsel, address your issue specifically when I call back on him. But unfortunately, you are in the same position as hundreds, if not thousands, of people are in right now. And that's just unfortunate situation that we're in today. And I'm frustrated by it as much as you are.
Well, okay. Well, Mr. Calvert has told me several different things that conflict. That I had dyes there, and he said, well, he would, if I could prove the dyes were mine, that I could get them back.
Okay, so I thought we were only talking about gold or silver. You're actually talking about dyes that you have?
Also.
You have dyes there as well. Well, that's an issue that I am going to address. If you have dyes there, then that's a different matter. Those have not been sold yet.
I guess my further issue is with Mr. Calvert himself.
Okay.
He kept telling me different things. At first he said I could just identify my dyes and show him some paperwork that I could get my dyes. And then at another time he said, even if I have the paperwork, he's just not going to give them back. And he said he's just going to melt them. He's going to sell them for scrap and melt them, all of them.
All right.
And
all right. Well, thank you, Ms. Carey. I will let Mr. Calvert and his lawyer respond to what you've said. I don't have any knowledge of that, so I'll hear what he has to say. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your coming in and letting the court know. All right. Ms. Pell, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
All right.
May I proceed?
Yes, please do.
My request of the court is really rather different from what has been discussed this morning. I am basically asking permission to make a presentation to the court on behalf of the unsecured creditors of Northwest Territorial Mint, Medallic. The problem that I face is that in order to make these requests and sound intelligent, I have to append exhibits, and these are accounting and inventory materials, many of which are part of the public record because of filings with the court. But some of them I possess in function of my role on the Unsecured Creditors Committee. Now, I have made a search of the docket and do not find that all of these documents are in the public sphere. Therefore, I am asking the court to waive the confidentiality agreement in part or in whole to allow me to put these issues before the court. And my basis is, for the request is the fiduciary duty owed by the UCC to the creditor class. This code imposes on UCC members an obligation as well as a right. The obligation is to represent the interests of the creditors. The right is to be able to inspect and or investigate the financial condition of the debtor. Some of these issues, many of them, have piecemeal come up in committee, but we have not received satisfactory answers. So I'm turning to the court to essentially force an explanation to the creditors. And as I said, there is some relief that might be afforded to the creditors at this last stage, where in fact everything is unwinding and turning to dust. Now, in searching through the materials that are available to the public already, I find many materials of a similar nature, such as dockets number 458 and 709. These documents list the detail of the precious metal assets returned to storage customers and their names. If such documents are public, there is no reason to withhold similar other documents. The other type of document that I use in my argument in support of the request are inventory numbers given by the trustee. And this may dovetail with Ms. Carey's preceding request in some way. There are other public records of similar material. Specifically, I give as an example the liquidation analysis of August 31st, 2016 that was posted to the creditor's website on October 3rd as Exhibit 3 and attached to the status report. Now, the documents I wish to use are needed as exhibits to explain and justify the request. Therefore, they're critical. Additionally, it is clear that Northwest Territorial Mint is no longer a going concern. Therefore, the question becomes, who and what is the confidentiality agreement protecting? Certainly not a business plan or a negotiation for sale. It seems to me that the creditors have a right of access, and I am therefore asking the court leave to use these accounting and inventory materials to make my request of the court, because I think there has been some deficiency in the services, the accounting services rendered to the estate. And these are the things that I would like to address. But before taking the plunge, I wanted to not get in trouble and make sure I had the permission of the court.
All right. Is there anything further, Ms. Pell?
No, that is all. If I get permission to attach these documents, then I would make my presentation and my request. I think the court has a choice of several ways to proceed, so I would like some instruction.
So let me ask you, Ms. Pell, is the reason that you want to present these documents to the court, is that to respond to the sale motion or to just generally address how this case was administered?
Well, on the sale motion, I feel that there may be precious metal inventory assets that are not accounted for or seem to sort of not be properly accounted for in the accounting records, and I discussed that at length. So that is part of this liquidation process. And I think addressing that issue before the liquidation process gets into full swing is important. The other request is just a general aid to creditors, which, given all the money that has been spent on accounting services, we really do not have any material which would aid us in filing our taxes. And I think the court must be well aware that a lot of the statements by the trustee and some of the accounting materials that have been put out there are conflicting and contradictory. So basically, I'm asking for this matter to be tidied up so that we can try to at least take our losses in a manner that is consistent with the IRC code. And this requires some kind of accounting review in a single document. And I think the request is not unreasonable given all of the interaction in court over so many complex details. It is hard to know when to insert this argument. So I apologize if I'm not in the right place at the right time.
No need to apologize, Ms. Pell. I understand, and as you actually aptly put it, when do you raise this? And now seems as good a time as any, I understand, now that the assets are about to be liquidated, putting forth your issues. And the court has read your papers as well as that of Mr. Hansen. I did take those statements by you and Mr. Hansen more at going toward the general issues that you have with how this case had been administered as opposed to an actual reason for not approving the sale. That's how I've interpreted what you're asking for. But it seems like you're saying you believe this information would be relevant.
Yes, I do. I think so that when Mr. Northrup stated that really, there isn't much that the committee can do because obviously there's going to be no recovery. That is correct, and we recognize that. And your perception of disaffection with the administration of the estate is correct. We feel that. And quite frankly, the requests that I would like to submit to the court are actually looking forward rather than looking back, and namely, could the creditors have some relief in the accounting department so that they can properly file their tax returns? There's a tax law change, and so the 2017 tax year is the last year where we may put this in. And there have been a lot of conflicting statements, as you are well aware, and that I point out in my documentation, because my text is already written. I am just waiting for your approval to submit it, because as I said, I do not wish to be in violation of any bankruptcy code rule. I'm pleading for relief on behalf of the creditors on that one item. The second item pertains strictly to the storage customers and the accounting of the metals totals. And Ms. Carey just brought up the issue of inventory sheets, and lo and behold, some of the things that I append to my discussion are indeed inventory sheets. And I do think that the creditors have a right to see this material and know it. And of course, the trustee can respond to it if there are any questions or misinterpretation.
Okay. Ms. Powell, thank you very much. I do appreciate it, your comments. I'm going to take a short recess till 12:05. I'm going to come back. I'm going to turn back to Mr. Guerin, and I'm also going to want to hear from Mr. Northrup to respond to what Ms. Pell has said, as well as to what all the other parties have said. I do still have a number of questions I want to raise, and then I do anticipate making some preliminary rulings and guidance going forward. So, Ms. Pell, I hope you can hang on for a little bit longer.
Just a question about procedure. Should I hang up and dial back in, or shall I just leave my phone live?
Just leave your phone on.
Okay.
All right, we're going to put you on mute so you won't hear us, but we're going to take a short 10-minute break and be back at 12:05. We'll be in recess.
Put me on mute. Don't forget to switch me back on.
We won't. All right, thank you, Ms. Pell. We'll be in recess until 12:05.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Please be seated. All right, I think we heard from everyone that wanted to be heard. Is there anyone in the courtroom that wanted to be heard that hasn't spoken? All right, I'm going to turn this back over to Mr. Guerin. You may respond to anything that you've heard. And I have a number of questions. I mean, I can ask my questions, or you can respond. I'll leave it up
here to you, whichever you like, Your Honor.
Why don't I ask my question? Because that probably
cut down to some of the things.
I think that's right. I mean, really, my questions relate to what was raised. So let me pull those up. Well, let me start with my questions. Well, let's start with what the last two people who spoke, and also I'm sure you've seen what Mr. William Hansen, not to be confused with Ross Hansen, filed. Ms. Pell, you're still there, right?
Yes.
All right. What do you have to say, and how do you want to respond, and what should I do, if anything, today about that?
Your Honor, I don't think these things are at all relevant to what's before the court presently. One thing I've confirmed is there is no precious metal that is being sold in either of the sales that we're bringing forward. There's no precious metal left, from what I understand, at the mint.
There's a little bit for the silver bullets, and there are sample silver bullets in somebody's offices, but generally there is no storage or inventory of precious metal.
So we're not talking about disposing of anything further. If there are issues about, you know, past accounting for precious metal, I understand there are many storage inventory customers that have come forward and have asked about, well, where did my metal go, right? Why isn't it there? They still think it is there. They still assert, you know, I know it's got to be there, those kinds of things. So I'm sensitive to the comments of Ms. Carey, right, where she's really concerned about what's happened to her metal. But as you indicated earlier, the trustee did an extremely thorough job. We took painstaking efforts to do a complete canvas with pictures and photographs under security camera observation, and many times with the oversight of the FBI, who Mr. Calvert invited in to participate in the process of inventorying what metal was there at the time he took possession of the custody of the assets. And then we provided reports to you, detailed reports, where we went back and we took efforts to give back whatever we could identify that belonged to a customer. We gave it back to them, including to Ms. Pell, by the way, who received some of that metal. So I don't think that there is any, I know that there's not any other metal there that we've identified to another customer. I don't think there's anything we can do about that right now. On the issues of whether there should be some review, some report, some complaints about the performance of the trustee or the other parties in the case, I think those could be addressed in the fee application process, for example. But I don't think they're relevant at all to the issues that are before the court presently. And I think if Ms. Pell wants to file a motion to address issues about the relief from the confidentiality agreement, the joint privilege agreement that we have with the committee, I think we could address it on a motion basis. I don't want to duck that issue. I don't think we should be waiving the privilege that is in existence between the committee and the trustee. And there are privilege materials there that should not be subject to release. I don't want to see that waived. I do think that if Ms. Pell wants to submit something, she conceivably could disclose that to Mr. Northrup, and he could advise her as a member of the committee as to whether or not there are privileged communications in those materials or whether they are not. I think those issues are not remain to what we're dealing with right now. I think they can be dealt with in a more
another time. All right, I understand. I'm going to focus my questions, I think, largely on the dyes, because that you have to say. I know the trustee has similar concerns, but I want to talk or ask some questions about that. So you've said there's the written policy concerning ownership of the dyes, and is that the policy that's on the website? Is that the written policy you're referring to?
Well, that is what I'm referring to, is in writing, Your Honor, that I've seen thus far.
Right.
There may be other written, adoptions of that elsewhere. I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know. I do not have not personally seen anything else other than what's on the website.
Well, so do you know if the website or this policy was presented to customers when they ordered the dyes?
I don't.
That was somewhat rhetorical. I didn't think you would, and I don't know how the trustee would. I mean, this, Mr. Colwell says in his email to Mr. Ilg that, you know, he, if it up to him, it would be returned, the dye would be returned to Mr. Ilg. And Mr. Colwell is the person who is a salesperson. Seems like he might have better knowledge than Mr. Wagner, who is the CIO, as to what the practice was. I mean, you kind of see where I'm going here. If you're trying to say the deal was based upon either practice or a website, I don't know if I can resolve that today or without an adversary proceeding. I'm not sure how I resolve that issue. I guess I'm still open to suggestions on what you want to do to get that resolved. I'm not inclined to force people to file a brief in 5 days. I'm not sure how you get it resolved before the 23rd, and I'm not sure. It strikes me is that if you want to assert that you have the right to sell, the burden is going to be on you to prove that, your client. How do we get there? And both the notice issues that Ms. Kaplan raised. I guess maybe there are a couple of buckets here. You've got some stuff that you can maybe figure out. I mean, if you look on a coin and it says the Jones Foundation, you might be able to contact the Jones Foundation. But some other stuff you may not. Some stuff's really old. Some stuff's not. I mean, we've got an invoice here from sold to Mr. Gary Marks, which says 3D custom coining dies, $700. So I assume you've got other invoices like that. Why can we review those invoices and contact those people that sold dies and at least ask them or give them notice?
Like I said earlier, Your Honor, I don't think there's any practical way for us to go back through all of the customer records and notify every customer that paid for tooling and dying. And I don't think that the fact that they paid for the tools and dies, by the way, is dispositive in any way of whether they own them. And I think it is that's something that we can present further evidence on that. But I think it is the industry custom that the customer pays for the tool and dying, but that doesn't mean that it didn't the dies did not then belong to the mint, right? To the manufacturer. I think there's not a practical way for us to go give notice to everybody. And so my proposal is that we give notice to the people that we know about, and we will deal with those issues. And if you don't think it'd be done on the 23rd, then we need to find the earliest possible date. Maybe it's the sale date by which we would, you know, have you rule on this, have people submit their proof. And I think that there may be exceptions, right? And I think we've said that in our pleadings. There may be some exceptions.
Oh, yeah,
given some guys back to people who have provided proof to us that they had a specific documentation that said, when I pay for this dye, it belongs to me, the customer.
So you've seen some of those. How many?
Yeah, I think we have. My recollection is, I know there's one that we gave back when we filed the motion on giving back the customer story.
Oh, I remember that.
Right? So that one in particular, we specifically identified, and we got authority from you to give back dyes generically that we could confirm belong to another customer. And I also, my recollection, I haven't gone back and looked at this, but I believe the Cavley Foundation, when they first came into the case, and I think we had an agreement with them, we gave them their dyes back. And there may be others. And Mr. Colwell's testimony, I haven't seen the new emails.
It's not testimony at this point. We're all just kind of trying to get our handle on what the situation is. I'm not going to make any ruling. I'm not.
Yep.
You understand.
I do understand, but I'm telling you there are many other witnesses, employee witnesses, that take the contrary position to Mr. Colwell. There's going to be an issue about what Mr. Colwell's authority was. We are sensitive. Mr. Ilg, for example, I'd like to find a way to work a solution for Mr. Ilg, and I think the trustee has said, if we can turn him over to another manufacturer right now and allow the dyes to be used with his permission to facilitate his business, I think we'd be willing to work with him on that so we could pick another manufacturer like Metalcraft or somebody else that's acceptable to him, and if he wants to work it, like something like that out, we would work it out. Not conceding any issues about the ownership of the dies and whether they can be transferred, but to accommodate his need to have his business concerns addressed. So I acknowledge it is a cumbersome and it is the only difficult issue that I think we really have here in terms of, you know, whether we can sell these assets. But my proposal was to set something on the hearing before, preferably before the auction date, and I'm thinking the auction date is going to be March 6th with the hearing on the 9th. I thought we'd have the alternative bids that would be due under our bid procedures that we proposed that we were going to consider in a couple of weeks. We would have the bids come in on the 5th, and I think it would be helpful to have...
Oh, you mean the auction, not the Murphy auction, but the auction...
If there's going to be an auction of sales, right, under the bid procedures.
And that's only one of the two APAs. The one for $700,000 is involving the sale of...
Dies. Correct. I should say, Your Honor, there is some urgency in getting that sale concluded, too. That's not because the buyer there is buying goodwill, buying customer relationships. And those relationships, many of them are schools and universities, and there's a springtime product that they are expecting. So it's that buyer is expressing interest in moving that process forward, closing on that deal as quickly as he can. So there'll be some concerns if we have to back that up to resolve issues attendant to the sale motion.
And there are other reasons to get this done. Just the sooner the trustee can liquidate and shut down costs, the better. So there are a number of reasons to get this done quickly. You got to balance that with the due process, and I don't have to tell you that. So so the ownership, so there's really two issues. There's one, whether the die is an asset of the estate that can be sold, normally decided by adversary proceeding. But then second, even if the die is, you've got the question is, can you sell it free and clear of the interests? And I think you've acknowledged that the interests are intrinsic. There's intellectual property that you're not selling and you can't sell. And this is maybe to be decided another day, but this is the question I have. If you're telling me is that the Mint or Medallic owns these dies but can't use them without customer permission, is that really ownership? And maybe it's an asset of the estate, but what can you sell if you can't use it without permission?
Well, I think we've talked about it a little bit already.
Yeah.
I do think it's the physical die that is a question here. And I don't think that the customer has an interest in the die just because it's image. There's some image of it that is imprinted on the die. The customer has an interest in the intellectual property and the right to use
right.
it, but it does not have an intrinsic right to the die itself. And I think those things are two separate property interests.
But they are and they aren't. I mean, you sell this at an auction, if it's Murphy or Metalcraft. Not, was it Metalcraft? They're not doing the auction. Yeah,
no,
that was the other one. It was the other first one. But let's say it's done by auction and someone buys a die. How are you going to know if that buyer is going to agree to honor the intellectual property rights of the customer?
Well, it's not going to be sold at auction. I don't
think
we're going there. I think that right now Mr. Calvert is, we're selling all the Medallic dies to Metalcraft under the existing proposal. And Mr. Calvert is negotiating now with other parties who would take the other dies. Right, so
the Metalcraft dies.
The Northwest Territory Mint dies and the older than 20-year dies.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So we're going to know. We're going to know who the party is that's going to
All right. So let's say you know who it is. And you're going to say you can't, you're going to put in the APA, you can't use the dies without having an agreement with the customers. And if you say that, how does the trustee enforce that? Because what I don't want to have is Mr. Ilg having to sue somebody, stop the use of his dies. Use of intellectual property that's associated with the dies. Let's assume I agree with you that the Mint owns it. And I'll say the Mint because there's substantive consolidation, whether it's a Medallic die or a Mint die, I'll just call them Mint dies. You sell a Mint die that's got Mr. Ilg's intellectual property on it, and the buyer says, I'm going to use it. What's, does Mr. Ilg now got to hire a lawyer? I mean, that, and you don't need to have an answer, somewhat rhetorical, but that's the concern I have here.
Okay.
And I don't know how to deal with that, and you don't, there may not be an easy answer today, there may not be an easy answer ever, but that's what I'm wrestling with here.
Well, I guess I don't want to be cavalier about it, but I don't think that is the concern of the bankruptcy estate and this administration, this case. I think that if the trustee were violating the copyrights of these parties, then parties would have recourse to come in and deal with him on whether he improperly used their intellectual property. But if he transfers a package of assets to somebody and they violate the copyright, then the issues are between the customers and that party who is violating their copyright. And it is not the case, I've heard Mr. Hyatt say, that it is certain that whoever acquires these dyes is going to use them. That's not true. I mean, I think these Metalcraft's a sophisticated mint producer of materials and knows how to deal with customers and knows it needs licenses. And I think you can put preservative language in an order if you like to make it clear that the intellectual property rights are not transferred and there's no right to use the dyes or use any of the protecting intellectual property rights of the customers that arises from the transfer of the dyes pursuant to the sale. It's not in the purchase and sale agreement. The language that you talked about is not in the current purchase and sale agreement, to my recollection. What is in the purchase and sale agreement is two things. One, we are selling them the company-owned dyes. We're selling, that's what the specific language is in this in the agreement. And our warranty doesn't warrant title. Right? So, you know, from my perspective, and we can talk to the buyers about this, make sure it's clear with them, but if there is a legitimate customer that comes back later and brings, you know, proof forward and says, I paid for this dye, I had an agreement with the Dalek and the Mint, I own the dye, and they present that evidence to the buyer, and they would have an ability to resolve that issue with the buyer post sale.
Okay. I got a phone or a computer near a...
Sorry.
Thank you. All right. These are difficult issues, to say the least. And while this isn't before us today, the Murphy auction motion has had a deadline to pull items from the auction to avoid paying fees to Murphy. I assume you've revised that deadline now.
Well, we'll have to talk to Mr. Murphy about that. But
okay.
You know, we know that we're continuing that, and
right.
I don't think I've heard the court.
You know, we're going to continue that. Yeah, I'm not denying it. We're going to continue it. The purpose today is we're going to get some sort of timeline we're going to at least try to get some sort of timeline for resolving some of these outstanding issues. My last question is, well, this is more about the money and that I asked last time, what about the money that was seized by the factor? Obviously, we got a borrowing motion coming up next week or 2 weeks, and the question's still on my mind. Do you have that money yet? Did you get that?
Well, status is Mr. Calvert's been in constant contact with the factor. The last numbers I saw a couple of days ago were that factoring line's now been paid down to under $100,000. So there's a residual equity in the factored receivables that we told you is in the range of $100,000. I think that is still the case, and I think if you look in the cash collateral budget, you'll see the factor has agreed to release 50 of that next week, right? And then the other 50 as soon as the rest of the factoring line is paid off, which I think we've got projected out a couple weeks later.
2 weeks later.
2 weeks later. There are also unfactored receivables, and those are in the cash collateral budget, and we expect to collect those as well.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Guerin,
I have a few other things I wanted to address.
I'm just going to see if I've got some other questions, and then I will let you make your further comments. Mr. Smith referred to, or I talked with Mr. Smith about what he thought needed to be set aside from the sale proceeds for his client's secured claim, the disputed secured claim. What, do you have a view on that, or is that something you guys will be able to work out?
I think we're going to have to run a calculation and an estimate of that. I don't think we would, but I certainly, I have no problem working with Mr. Smith. I think we work very well together on those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
I don't think it is Mr. Smith's characterizing that we're reserving everything. We have confirmed that, the Hoffs have an obligation under Nevada law to mitigate their damages. And given your order of 2 weeks ago, they should be doing that now, right? They should be taking steps as you've given them permission to come in and start to market the property and so forth. So, you know, I heard a characterization of these lease, you know, rejection claims are going to be more than $1 million. I don't think that's true. I think it's going to be significantly less than that. And I think if the suggestion is that, as has been made before, this is a highly marketable space, there should be a new tenant in there, and we should be able to cut off some of those.
I think the $1 million is kind of on the outside, and that's the number I'm using too. Just kind of if they are unable to find a new tenant, that's kind of on the high side. Hopefully they do, and by all indications, that's their plan too. If they'd rather have a paying tenant than an administrative expense claim, but it could be in that range.
At the very
hopefully
high
not. End. Hopefully not. But that's on the outside.
Yep.
Anyway, that's the only other question I had, so I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, thank you, Ronnie. So I'll go back and walk through, I think, in order of what was presented this morning. And so starting with the Hoffs, I mean, I think the MALP issue, and I think you can see I have some frustration with that, because I do believe that that issue is not does not merit any further briefing or energy or cost or expense to this estate or the other parties. And I will say flat out, Your Honor, if Mr. Hansen forces that to a conclusion right now, forces to go forward with that briefing, then I think you should consider Rule 11 at the time you make those rulings. I think you should, because I'm telling you that I do not believe there's any evidence they're going to uncover that's going to change that circumstance. He's not submitted anything yet. He's fully aware of what the facts are. He's fully aware that he's taken a position in the past that those assets were transferred from MALP to MAC LLC. And so I think Mr. Smith wants to characterize it as a data dump that we gave you on Wednesday night, which was the deadline for providing those responses. We provided a significant evidence prior to Wednesday. What we added on Wednesday was the tax returns that had given you a signal and told you we would present when we had a hearing a couple of weeks ago. Mr. Smith also talked about the statute of frauds, and he thinks that's an impediment here, and that's some reason why there'd have to be a document or a bill of sale or some kind of a written record that evidences that transfer in order to be for it to be effective under Nevada law. And we've addressed that in our briefing with you, and I think what we've told you is they don't have standing to raise that issue. That's an issue between the parties. So if MALP wanted to raise that issue, MALP could raise it, but the Hoffs don't have any standing to do so. And Mr. Smith admitted in the comments that he made to you that he does not have any contrary evidence with respect to the MALP issue. He told you that flat out. So from the Hoffs perspective, I don't see any way they're ever going to develop anything that's going to change that. Neither of these parties are going to be able to develop any evidence that's going to address that issue or shed any further light on it. So I want to move past that, and I think the court should, I think you should rule on it presently based on the existing record. I think there's been an adequate opportunity for MALP to show up, and the idea that MALP is going to go back and reinstate that entity, and we're going to be dragged out for who knows how long in trying to resolve that issue. Not practical, not reasonable. MAPS had a full opportunity to go and appear and present the evidence, whatever evidence they might have, that the assets were not transferred. Turning to the Pan American questions, I think this kind of goes to the issue about the dyes and who owns the dyes. And the consignment agreement, and we quoted this language, the consignment agreement with Pan American, between Pan American and the bankruptcy and the Northwest Territorial Mint. The language in the consignment agreement says, all right, title, and interest in and to the designs struck on both sides of the coins, the designs of the bars, quote the designs, and all dies and tooling used to make the coins and bars, and all copyrights, trademarks, and other intellectual property rights embodied or incorporated in the designs, in the products, handle in the dies and tooling used to make the coins and bars shall be owned exclusively by the consignee. The consignee is the company, is Northwest Territorial Mint. So it's abundantly clear in that consignment agreement between Pan American and the Northwest Territorial Mint who owned the dies with respect to that agreement. Mr. Hyatt wants to point the language about what happens at the end of termination, and there is a clause in the agreement that says on termination, you're supposed to return these dies back to the consignor. There's no dispute that Northwest Territorial Mint has breached that agreement in a number of ways, and I suppose there may be a claim for non-performance on what happened on termination of the agreement. There is, and that claim's been asserted in the state. But that does not address the issue about who owned the dies, which I think is clearly characterized in this language that we quoted in our briefing with respect to the ownership of the dies by the consignee. I don't think there's any, with Seabright's comments, I think we actually are in accord with some of the positions that have been taken by the Boy Scouts. I think it's the first time I've heard them come in and say they actually think they own the dies. I think the conversations I've had before have all been surfaced around the intellectual property and the licenses. And I think we are in agreement with the Boy Scouts with respect to the licenses and the intellectual property rights. We're not intending to use them. We're not intending to sell them to anybody. I think we've said that a number of times, and so I don't think that's an issue. The issue about the dies, I think we still have, we still will be at issue with the Boy Scouts with respect to the die ownership for them as well. Turning to Mr. Powers' comments, I'm a little confused as to who Mr. Powers represents right now. I don't know whether he represents Mr. Hansen, whether he represents the MALP. Does he represent Mr. Parrish as somebody who's made an offer to buy the assets? Or does he represent the Haas, who he seems to make arguments on their behalf as well? So it's a little confusing to me as to who he's here for. I do think there is a frustrating point of this, of Mr. Hansen coming in and making arguments about how this estate should be administered, and creditors' rights, and those kinds of things. Mr. Hansen, not a creditor in this case. He doesn't have any standing in this case. He's not an offer. He's not offering to purchase assets. He's already testified in prior depositions. He doesn't have any resources. So he really has no standing to make any comments in this case at all. And the idea that he's going to be allowed to come back in and obstruct our ability to come in and liquidate these assets again, as he has done in prior proceedings before this court, I don't think that should be countenanced. Mr. Powers' comments about the prior litigation, I think your response to that is accurate. And what I want to focus on is the only issue we were talking about in the summary judgment proceedings that he has been talking about was the lease. We weren't talking about the other assets. And your ruling was directly about the lease. And we were telling you that there was a difference with the lease, right? We thought the lease was different from the other assets. And we knew we had to substantively consolidate all of the other assets. But we told you we thought there had been an assignment of the lease from MAC LLC to Northwest Territorial Mint. And we had evidence that we presented in the form of deposition testimony and trial testimony from Mr. Hansen, where he said that was true. So you denied summary judgment, and we're going to have to litigate those issues at trial. But it has nothing to do with these issues about whether MALP might still have an interest in these assets or whether they all belong to MAC LLC. And the reason that MALP was not named as a party in that lawsuit, and it never became a point of contention through the substantive consolidation litigation, was that it was uncontroverted. You know, the testimony that was provided, the complaint that was filed by MAC LLC, all the records that we had seen, it was clear that the assets did belong, were on the books of MAC LLC. And there was no entity left, no MALP entity left anymore to hold any assets. So I think that whatever we've done in the past is not at all inconsistent with the position we're taking today, which is those assets belong to substantially consolidated MAC LLC. The suggestion that Mr. Hansen is here to save the business, maybe I don't even really need to talk about that. Mr. Parrish, whether, and if Mr., there's some thought that, that Mr. Powers is here on behalf of Mr. Parrish, who has tendered a $1 million offer. And he says that may be a better offer than what's on the table today. You know, I don't think it's even close as to what was offered between Mr. Parrish and the other offers that we've been able to put together. Mr. Parrish's offer was to acquire all the assets of the company, everything, for $1 million, which included causes of action the trustee had against Mr. Hansen and Ms. Erdman, for example, the same causes of action that you heard testimony on a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, he wanted to acquire, he really was trying to head off, I think, moving forward with that trial, and it was a bundle of assets that the trustee did not intend to sell. And the value that he was providing, I told Mr. Powers this the day after I got that offer, was the value wasn't even close to being in the range of what the trustee would consider selling the assets for. We've already seen the movie with Mr. Parrish before. Mr. Parrish was supposed to be the funding source for the $1 million offer that Mr. Hansen made to buy the Tomball, Texas assets. And that turned out to be fictitious. It turned out that Mr. Parrish didn't have the resources to go forward and to support the $1 million offer in a Tomball circumstance. We took Mr. Parrish's deposition after the, I think in the course of the dispute about the Todd Tracy retainer money. Mr. Parrish told us his net worth was somewhere in the range, his entire net worth was in the range of $1.5 million to $2 million. And that, you know, his wife would kill him, effectively, I'm paraphrasing, but his wife would kill him if he, you know, had to loan $1 million or give $1 million to Mr. Hansen to support some kind of a sale. So it's a fiction, and we shouldn't waste any time with it. I mean, I don't have any problem with Mr. Parrish or any other bidder, and the trustee has invited a number of parties. Somebody wants to bid on these assets, and they want to provide financial wherewithal proof, just like everybody else is going to do to qualify as an alternative bidder. They'll have an opportunity to view the assets. I think the assets are clearly defined right now in the purchase and sale agreements that are in front of you. The idea, Mr. Powers says, well, there's some confusion about what these assets are that the trustee was selling. But if anybody knows what these assets are and what's being sold, it's Mr. Hansen. So there's no confusion about what it is we are trying to sell. And there certainly isn't any more now that we have filed the purchase and sale agreements. I'll turn to Ms. Kaplan's questions and issues. I think Ms. Kaplan talks about it's really specific around the ownership of the dies, and I think we beat that ad nauseum. I think we do have to come up with a process to deal with it. I will say that the declaration we put in for Mr. Wagner is not expert testimony. Mr. Wagner is an employee of the Mint who knows about what the policies and practices were, and he knows a fair amount about the relations between customers and the company. So it's not provided as expert testimony, but we'll provide other testimony. I think the issue about Mr. Colwell's testimony, you're going to have to weigh that evidence for weight in terms of what Mr. Colwell says. And it's just possible, as I've said, that when we discuss with Mr. Colwell and other employees of the Mint, that we will discover that there are exceptions and we should come to you and say we should give some of these dies back to people. I think I've already addressed Mr. Ilg's issues, Your Honor. I think that we understand he's bound up in this disposition. His dies are Northwest Territory Mint dies. They're not part of the Metalcraft sale. We can find a way to resolve those as soon as possible, but I would also like to find a solution for Mr. Ilg on his business questions, and I would invite him to have a conversation with the trustee about that after the conclusion of the hearing.
Mr. Ilg is still here, so you heard all that, Mr. Ilg?
Yes.
All right.
Your Honor, I did.
All right.
I think that covers, because I think I've already talked about the Ms. Carey's issues and Ms. Pell's issues. So unless you have further questions, Your Honor.
I guess, and I think we're all kind of beating this, but it's important because it's a big part of it, the tools and the dies. Well, let me ask this question, if anyone knows. What are these dies worth? If you sold all 304,000 dies, just generally, what is their value? I want to know what dollar amount we're talking about here, because I know Mr. Marks, I'm picking on him because I have his sales order acknowledgement at $700. So that's, you know, that's the what he paid, and yet he will, both sides will probably argue the die is worth more than just that $700, probably. I don't know. I guess I'm asking. Do you have an idea, Mr. Calvert or Mr. Guerin or anybody else?
I'll take one stab at it, and Mr. Calvert can...
Well, I'll hear from Mr. Ilg and Ms. Carey, because they've raised their hands.
What I'll say is, you know, we know that in the Metalcraft agreement, there's $700,000 for a package of materials which include those dies.
Right.
So, you know, they're not worth the cost, right? I don't think they're worth cost, because if there's thousands of them times $7 or whatever, I think...
Or 700, but still, you know, yeah.
But I think, because I think the value of them really is inherent and tied in with goodwill, right? Okay. So I think that's really what the dies represent, is they represent an aspect of goodwill.
Right, okay.
Now, so I don't know if you can break it out.
Right? All right.
I think that, you know, disposing of those dies, right, if there wasn't a goodwill sale like this, or wasn't somebody who wanted to come in and buy them for that purpose, there's racks and racks of them. I mean, I've seen them. I mean, they're you know,
304,000. I mean, I can't imagine. Three, even if they're small, that's lots.
So the cost of cost of disposition of them,
right?
You know, could exceed whatever value. And I think they have value to each individual customer, because I know the customer paid for them.
Oh, right.
Right.
Right. Because Mr. Ill, you were going to say. Can you just come up? And Ms. Carey, if you want to speak, you can come up as well. Just very briefly, what are these worth? And briefly, if you could.
It's difficult to say. We've developed a client base, hundreds, several thousand clients, many of them institutional. Some of them employ our dye product material at 1¼ inches, 1½ inches. We've approached through the Duwamish Longhouse administration, we've approached the mayor's office, and we've approached a number of other corporations, including Siemens Corporations, 1¾ inches, 3 ounces of silver in a lovely leatherette box, corporate gifts. I have no idea what the constellation of businesses given a year from now, 2 years from now, 2 years from now, given a supply of inventory in stock, it's difficult for me to put a value on.
It's the use to be able to use and make money from the dye. In your case, be able to make money from using.
Right.
Okay.
In various products, combined with wood, combined with leather, combined with glass. We've approached glass manufacturers, and the physics of glass and the physics of copper are very similar. At 2,500 degrees, they expand and contract. We've had all these discussions with all these fellow manufacturers for co-evolved or co-designed products.
All right.
So
thank
for
you,
that reason,
that's,
I can't
that's helpful.
Pin it down.
All right. Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah. Ms. Carey, do you have anything that you'd like to add briefly? Okay. Please come forward. And you have to speak into a mic. That's the only reason why I'm asking you to come forward. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I pull the mic down to you.
I'd like to answer your question about what the dyes are worth, but I also would like to assert that they're not being honest.
Okay. Well, I'd like to just focus on the dyes.
What they just recently said.
About what?
About the dyes going back to somebody. Either Mr. Calvert was lying to me, or he's not being honest with the court right now. Because Mr. Calvert told me that, and then he gave me permission to record his calls, except the, he didn't want me to record the last ones, but he said to me that nobody's getting their dyes back, okay. That 10 have tried, and not one of them have, and nobody has ever gotten their dyes back. I mean, he made it sound like it's just impossible to get your dye back.
Okay. Well, I'll ask Mr. Calvert about that in a moment.
This gentleman just testified that some people have gotten their dyes back, so I'd like to know who.
Well, I think there were one or two that was done by, well, it was done by a motion. The trustee requested permission from the court to return these dyes. I think it was one or two folks. I'd have to go back and look at the papers that were filed in this case. But a couple of people did
get
their
well,
I understand you're saying that were told that.
It seems like I get stonewalled.
I understand. I'll ask Mr. Calvert in a second about that. Tell me about the value.
The value in particular of my dyes is to, mine are like for charity. When somebody does a nice favor, or we call them favor coins. Somebody does a nice favor and they, you know, don't expect anything in return. If you give them a coin and then sometime that coin's value can go up by what you pay back, what you buy it for. A coin that they know that they've never intended to get or anything, just a gift. And then to make the value of that gift go up by buying it back at some later point, if they want it, or if they want to keep it. So if my dyes were sold, and then, because I've already given some to the, not multiple sclerosis, but the, a neurological disease.
An organization, charitable organization.
Right, right. So that makes those, the value of those go down if there are other ones. Mine are numbered, even.
It's hard to, I think it's going to say it's hard to put a value on it.
But I also paid for them, and I was told that they were a work of, or a work product of my own, and that the copyright is in my name, and
all right.
That they belong to the customer. The reason that you keep them at the place is so that you can use them and so that they don't get damaged. I mean, they have a much better facility than, say, me, you know.
Well, when you bring them in, say, hey, I
right.
want some coins.
Right, because they're easily damaged.
Right, I understand. All right, thank you, Ms. Carey. All right, thank you. And Ms. Kaplan, you raised your hand. You can sit there, just pull the mic towards you.
Okay, thank you. With respect to the trustee talking about the sale and wanting to go forward and really selling the goodwill, I guess my question is, where is the goodwill derived from these dyes? Is it the actual metal of the dye? I don't think so. Or is it the images that are on them, which the images are clearly the customer's copyright? Or is it the prospective relationship, business relationship with these customers that they're going to come back and do repeat business? So you're selling goodwill, but...
Well, I mean, I think that's,
I
mean,
think
that's
that
the
value.
That's one of the concerns I have is that can you separate the intellectual property, which is copyrights, trademark, and goodwill, from the dye? Can you sell? Is it? Are you selling free and clear of that interest? I don't know the answer, and I can't. I'm not going to get an answer today.
Right.
So, but that to me is a critical issue that needs to be resolved. What have customers been told with respect to the dye ownership? I know what's on. I saw this email sent by Debbie Davis on Monday, January 22, that says, in essence, it's not the Mint's policy, it's not the Mint's policy to give away our dye. So I understand that that's been was said to at least to Mr. Gary Marks, but what have customers been told, Mr. Calvert, Mr. Guerin? Is that what they've generally been told?
I'm still researching this myself, but what I understand is at this point is Medallic had a very clear policy Medallic would not return any of the dyes, and that was part of the mystique of Medallic. And it is, as outlined earlier, the customer annuity basis of the value of the dyes. And Mike stated that, you stated that, that the value is the customer will come back and produce more dyes. And that's why Metalcraft is only interested in the last 20 years of dyes, because they want the customer base.
Sure, and that makes sense. It's a symbiotic relationship.
That is there.
There's goodwill going both ways.
Probably. Exactly, and the maintenance of them in that way too. So they're looking for that customer base. That's what they're looking for. They didn't want any dyes further back. So as for, we know what the cost of production is, we know what we sell them for, and we know that there's a scrap value too. And in the case of Northwest Territory Mint, it may end up being scrap value, because the target right now is only Medallic dyes. The two buyers that I had at the table, the first being interested in the last 20 years, Metalcraft. There is another buyer that is interested in the ones older than 20 years. And from that perspective, they've given me an offer, and I have received a cash deposit on it. But I have not accepted that offer yet. So I don't have a complete answer for Your Honor on the Northwest Territory Mint dyes, but I'm pretty comfortable with what the rules were for the Medallic dyes.
Well, my question is, what has been communicated to folks? Because that's the concern that Ms. Carey raised, is that she is stating that she was told one thing that may not be necessarily what the reality is. I'm not going to have an evidentiary hearing today, but what are people being told? And maybe we just not need to say anything to anybody yet.
In the case of Medallic, it was clear. It was clear on the website. It was clear in the communications. It was clear in the purchase orders and alike. In the case of Northwest Territory Mint, I think there's inconsistency.
Inconsistency. All right. Mr. Elg, I don't think I need to hear any more.
Here's a quick example.
You need to come up to the mic, Ben. I'm sorry, and it's got to be quick, sir.
Here's a very brief example for
this image right here. we were told there's a coining image, not much relief, not much detail, between $300 and $400. That would be this kind of relief right here. For the splash cast die. Wonderful, unique, novel artistry, and fantastic detail, a couple of $1,000. If you wish to own the die, there's a premium. That's what we were told.
And that's on the mint side?
Yes.
Okay, all right. And at least that's what you were told.
That's what I was told, a verbal agreement, okay. 06, 07, 08.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hill. All right, it strikes me, Mr. Guerin, that we're going to need, don't we need at least an evidentiary hearing, because I'm going to need testimony from what people were told, what the industry standard was. Seems like I'm not sure I can do this on the papers, because, there seem to be two issues. One, who physically owns the die. Two, if the mint owns the die, can it be sold given the intellectual property and goodwill associated with it? That's more of a legal question, I think the latter part is, but certainly the former may be fact intensive, and at least that's what I have in my head. So let me, well, actually, before I get to my ruling, Mr. Northup, did you want to say anything in response to anything that's been said today?
No, Your Honor. I mean, we're resigned.
Can you pull the mic toward you? Sorry.
We're resigned, like Mr. Smith's client, to the sale process moving forward, and however an administrative way it ends up going forward. If you had any questions about any of the documents that were submitted by committee members, I would be happy to address those, although frankly I feel personally uncomfortable characterizing some of the materials that were submitted to the court.
All right, thank you, Mr. Northrup. All right.
Your Honor,
Mr. Powers, yes?
Have 1 minute to respond to a couple of the things that Mr. Guerin said about me.
Well, okay. Usually the moving party gets the last word.
I agree.
So, You have 1 minute. Yes, go ahead.
I hope it starts when I get to the mic.
Okay.
I represent Mr. Hansen.
I know that.
All right. And I submitted an offer, and Mr. Guerin knows that. I submitted an offer on behalf of Mr. Hansen that he arranged with Mr. Parrish through a company that he owned. And the trustee, and it's clear the trustee doesn't want to do business with Mr. Hansen, but Mr. Parrish's money spends just as well as anybody else's. At this point in the case, the only thing that money is going to go to pay for is administrative expenses. Trustee shouldn't care whether the assets go to Metalcraft or to a company set up by Mr. Parrish. And Mr. Parrish ought to be able, and Mr. Hansen ought to be able to participate in the auction. One last point on Mr. Parrish's prior involvement. I was in the background in one of those transactions. It was a transaction where the trustee would not let Mr. Parrish bid because Mr. Parrish couldn't produce a check for $200,000 in a few hours. That's the same sale that the trustee approved, or the trustee went forward with somebody and they didn't perform. Okay. So I'm just saying,
I don't want to get into side litigation about, because Mr. Guerin's going to want to respond, and I don't want to.
I'm just saying, if Mr. Parrish wants to bid and he's got a company, he should get the same treatment as anybody else, regardless of Mr.
Well, we're going to have a hearing on the bid procedures. So that's exactly. I'm not going to rule today that anything with regards to who gets to participate in the bidding process.
Thank you.
No, I think I should give my 20 seconds.
No, it's okay.
Yes.
No. I took your comments about who Mr. Powers represents as rhetorical arguments, and I smiled for a reason, because we know who Mr. Powers represents, but I understand what Mr. Guerin, what you're saying. Let me turn to, here's what the court's going to do today. The law, I think everybody knows generally, is that we have 363B that allows the trustee to sell property of the estate other than in the ordinary course of business after notice and hearing. And section 363F allows the trustee to sell property under subsection B or C free and clear of any interest in such property if the trustee meets one or more of the five conditions set in 363F. I think the issues here is 363F4, whether such interest is in a bona fide dispute, and then maybe 363F1, whether applicable non-bankruptcy law permits sale of such property free and clear of such interest. We also have F2 consent as another basis for doing that. We have a number of folks that are objecting that implicates 363F. However, as several parties have noted, while the trustee may sell property that is subject to a dispute of interest, the trustee cannot sell property unless it is property of the estate. If there is a question as to whether property is an asset of the estate, the court must reach that question first before it gets to Section 363F. One case making that point is In Re Clark, 266 BR 163 at 172, Ninth Circuit, BAP, 2001. Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Proceeding 7001, parens 2, provides that a proceeding to determine the validity, priority, or extent of a lien or other interest in property is an adversary proceeding. All right, so let's first turn to this trustee's request to sell the medallic assets. And let me preface all this by saying there's technically no motion that I'm ruling on today. I'm establishing some parameters to get us to a point where we can make a decision on the motions that are going to be heard on March 9. So with respect to the medallic assets, and again, that definition refers to the assets that were acquired from the Hoffs or the Hoffs company back in 2009. The trustee has made a prima facie case that the medallic assets are part of this estate. And that prima facie case is based largely on the statements and conduct of Mr. Hansen. Proof of claim number 2981, filed by Medallic Art Company, LLC, care of Ross Hansen, signed by Tom Bucknell as attorney for Medallic, states that
Medalik, under penalty of perjury, is asserting a claim for, among other things, monies and royalties due from the Mint. And when I say the Mint, I'm referring to Northwest Territorial Mint, the debtor, for leasing and using the assets acquired from the Hoffs. The proof of claim attached a copy of the complaint that Medalik filed against the trustee. Again, that proof of claim was submitted under penalty of perjury. In the adversary proceeding commenced by Medalik, represented by that complaint, Medalik, under the control and direction of Mr. Hansen, asserted and alleged repeatedly that it owned all of the assets acquired from the Hoffs. In that litigation, Mr. Hansen signed a declaration under penalty of perjury in opposition to the trustee's motion for summary judgment, stating that he had assigned his interest in the assets to Medalik Assets Limited Partnership, who we're referring to as MALP, and then he and Mr. Bressler formed Medalik LLC to acquire the assets. Specifically, he stated, quote, "It was my intention and understanding that Medalik LLC inherited, succeeded to, or obtained all right, title, and interest in the purchased assets as well as the leasehold from MALP." That's in the adversary proceeding number 16-1196 at docket number 24 at page 10. All of this constitutes some evidence that Medalik LLC acquired title to the Medalik assets, and because this court substantively consolidated Medalik LLC with the Mint, those assets would be part of the estate. Now, with his reply brief, the trustee has offered tax returns and financial statements that purportedly show that MALP had no assets at the end of 2009 and that Medalik LLC claimed ownership of those items. However, those documents should have been submitted with the motion, and the objecting parties have had no opportunity to respond, so it would be unfair for the court to use them in connection with this motion, or at least to use them today. While the trustee has clearly made a prima facie case that Medalik assets are part of the estate, there is also no dispute, the court has made note of this multiple times, that there is indeed a gap in the written chain of title. We have documentation showing the Hoffs sold to Hansen and Hansen assigned to MALP. All of that's in writing, but we do not have any written transfer or assignment documents from MALP to Medalik LLC or to the Mint. Mr. Hansen's declaration states that he had an intention and an understanding, which does not equate to a statement of fact. Hansen's and the Hoffs now want to assert that there is a dispute as to whether the Medalik assets are part of the estate. Given the trustee's evidence that I've just cited, including Mr. Hansen's own statement and conduct, and the tax returns that the trustee will certainly rely upon in any contested matter, the court will put the onus on Mr. Hansen and on the Hoffs to pursue a determination that the assets are not part of the estate. So, if the Hoffs, Mr. Hansen, or MALP want to argue that the assets are not part of the estate, that party shall file a verified complaint and commence an adversary proceeding, including the payment of the filing fee, by no later than February 22, 2018 at 5 p.m. Any party that does not commence an adversary proceeding by that date, the court will deem that party to have waived its objection to the sale on the basis that the estate does not own the Medalik assets. And I'm requiring that the parties file their own complaints. In other words, if the Hoffs want to file a complaint and Mr. Hansen wants to file a complaint, they each need to file separate complaints, and then the court will consolidate the adversaries. I'm requiring parties to individually file complaints for two reasons. First, I need the Hoffs, if they're going to pursue it, and I need Mr. Hansen, if he's going to pursue it, to clearly state their allegations and claims ASAP so the court can make a determination expeditiously. If there's only one complaint, then the other moves to intervene, and the matter's going to be delayed while we resolve that issue, and then if intervention is granted, there'll be more pleadings. I'm not going to have that. Second, if only one party files a complaint and the trustee prevails, I'm not going to have the other party say it's not bound by the ruling and still want to argue that the assets are not part of the estate. So, put up or shut up. That's the court's ruling on Medallic's assets. Let's turn to the security interest. I don't think this is a dispute. The court agrees that there is a bona fide dispute as to the asserted liens of the Hawks and of Pan American. The trustee may sell the assets of the estate free and clear of those liens pursuant to Section 363F4, but shall, as we said, retain sale proceeds sufficient to pay those potential secured claims. We've already discussed that. I don't think that's an issue. The third issue is the intellectual property associated with the items, and there was an objection to the sale of that, and I think it's been clarified that the trustee is not seeking to sell, not seeking authority to sell trademarks, copyrights, or other intellectual property. The proposed order seemed to be a little bit broader than the relief requested, so to be clear, the trustee is not seeking to sell that and will not be sold. In connection with the auction sale, to the extent we get to the auction sale. The tooling and the dies, and this remains an issue. I think we've discussed this at length, and I don't want to say ad nauseum because it's important. There are a lot of issues. There may be other ones we haven't even identified yet. But clearly, there are at least two primary issues. And one, does the Mint own the tooling and the dies? Are they part of the estate? And second, if they are, can they be sold with the intellectual property essentially attached to it without a license going along with it? I mean, I think of the example, if someone buys Mr. Ilg's dies, the buyer's going to go to Nordstrom and all those other clients that he talked about, and they're going to make the money. Now, that's not fair. Why is that not right, Mr. Calvert?
That's not right. What the buyer is really buying is the right to produce by that customer. They're really looking for him to come
but
over.
What's to stop him? What's to stop the buyer from saying, I don't care about Mr. Elg, I'm just going
to
do it.
Business model. The whole business model is just to retain the customer base and to produce that volume.
But the problem is I don't have any way of enforcing that. And that may be the customer model, but I don't have any way of enforcing that. And I don't think it's fair to put it on. Notwithstanding your argument, Mr. Darren, that maybe it's not the court's concern, but it is. We've already got thousands of unhappy people. I'm not going to create any more. No, Mr. Elk, I'm ruling now. So okay. So, you know, I understand what you're saying, Mr. Calvert, and I get that you make money by having the customer come in and order coins or product that has the art or the intellectual property attached to it. But who's to stop Metalcraft from then selling to somebody else and then selling to somebody else? I don't know. And I'm not making a ruling because the trustee may be able to do it, but I don't know. I think that there is a significant legal issue. We've got a number of people who are here, and so we can deal with those folks now. We can identify a timeline for addressing their concerns. And because I think it's fair to say that the original motion didn't really go into it. It was only in the oppositions that some of these issues were raised. So it's not been fully briefed. I think it's been partially briefed. But the question is briefing going to be enough? And I alluded to in the comments before I started my ruling, I still think I need an evidentiary hearing on the ownership issue. At least, if not an adversary proceeding. I guess let me hear from you, Mr. Guerin, and I'll go around the room to the folks that also are here on behalf of intellectual property owners, die owners. Do we need an evidentiary hearing?
I've been thinking about it as you're talking about it, Your Honor, and I think I'm kind of breaking it down into it. It seems to me there are some legal issues that you've identified that really can be resolved with briefing.
Right.
And those, I think, are whether the intellectual property is intrinsic to the die, right? Whether it's built into the die.
Right.
Such that it can't be separated from the die itself. And so
right.
That's a legal issue, I think.
Right. And at that point, it doesn't matter if the company owns it or not, you can't sell it.
There you go.
I think you're right.
I think you're resolving things. If you, one or the other, I think you're resolving things there.
Yeah.
Secondly, the issue about can it be sold free and clear, is that an interest, right?
Right.
An interest, intellectual property interest, and can we sell free and clear that? Those two legal issues, I think. You could resolve those on briefing, and you can resolve those pretty quickly, I think.
Okay.
Secondly, I think we could bifurcate the MALP issues, the MAC LLC issues from the Northwest Territorial Mint issues, because I think they are very different, as Mr. Calvert pointed out earlier. I do think that what you're going to hear, and do you still need an evidentiary hearing to decide the MAC LLC issues? Maybe so, but I think the policies are consistent there. I think the weight of the testimony you're going to get from the witness side, at least the people that we know about, is going to be consistent. And the Northwest Territorial Mint issues are a little more complicated than that. And we don't have a sale pending presently with respect to Northwest Territorial Mint.
So the Mandalic one is of more urgency.
Right. So if we could find a way to, schedule whatever evidentiary hearing we would need on the MAC LLC dies in advance of that sale hearing, and just deal with those discrete issues, which I'm telling you, there are only four parties that I'm aware of that we know about that have raised that issue.
With respect to Medallic dies.
With respect to Medallic LLC.
Medallic LLC dies. You said three that you know of.
Four
that you know of. Okay. And because what I'm thinking is, and I guess I'll come to folks on this side, what I'm thinking is, if we do an evidentiary hearing, does it make sense to consolidate it rather than to have four separate evidentiary hearings one per customer? I want to be efficient both for the court's time, but with the time of trustee and his counsel on these issues. So think about that. Anyone like to be heard on this? Ms. Kaplan?
I think an evidentiary hearing is appropriate too, because there is going to be a lot of fact-based testimony. You hit on the issue of what were the customers told and what documents were provided to them in terms of this is what our policies are when they first started the relationship.
Okay.
And then if policies changed, if customers over long-time relationships, were those provided to customers?
All right, thank you. And again, you said there are four, Mr. Guerin? Four that you know of?
I'm aware of, Your Honor. As I said, we're continuing to keep a list, but
right.
I think I told you in my initial comments, let me find my list. I think I told you who those were.
And you've been in contact with them?
We have.
Okay.
Through my office or through some of them contacted Mr. Wagner, some of them contacted trustees, so forth. So the ones that I'm aware of are the Arnold and Mabel Beckham Foundation.
Okay. Oh, you said these. Beckham Foundation. Can you give them to me?
I think I did.
Okay. Whatever they are, we'll keep and get back in touch with them. I think one of them is Brook Green Garden.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at my calendar here. So we with respect to the purely legal issues, we could do those before you have an evidentiary hearing on the Medallic dies, is what you're thinking?
I mean, I think those are applicable.
I think it's applicable to everybody.
Across the board, we could have anybody brief on the legal issues.
Right.
But I'm thinking, if we can do that in the next couple of weeks, that would be helpful.
All right.
Because otherwise, we're going to spend time getting ready for an evidentiary hearing that would be wasteful. Right? It could be wasteful.
Right. No, I agree. But these are complicated. I don't want to rush this dramatically. Because these are significant issues, and they're not easy. I want to give folks a little bit of time. And I know time is of the essence, and yet I'm not going to deny folks the opportunity to fully respond. So I think it's technically it's your burden, Mr. Guerin. So you should do the kind of the opening brief, And I'm thinking that you want it resolved before March 6th. I'm not sure that's possible, at least on the intellectual property issue. And certainly, if you want to do the evidentiary hearing after we resolve the IP issue, you're not going to have it done before the 9th. Unless you, let me ask you this: how long do you want to take to put together your brief on these IP issues? You want a week? You want 2 weeks? I was thinking you want 2 weeks, but it's kind of up to you.
Your Honor, I mean, I told you the pressure we have is whether we can hold the Metalcraft deal together if we have to get it delayed, right? So that's why I do want to make sure that we can move it up, move it forward. Could we get 10 days? Could we get till Monday to file our briefing, our opening briefing on those two issues, and then figure out, back it up from there, I suppose.
Monday the 19th?
That would be, I mean, look at
you're talking 10 holiday. Days, not next Monday.
No, that's right. I'm talking 10 days.
All right. Well,
so that's a holiday, I understand.
Right. So that would be the 20th. I mean, you're planning to do your auction if there are competing bids on Metalcraft on March 6th? Is that the current plan? Is that
that was my thinking, Your Honor.
Could you, and what time were you planning to do that? Start in the morning?
I don't have anything fixed at this point. I mean, normally we do it in the morning. I mean, we want to have an opportunity to provide briefing to the court for the hearing on the 9th after the sale, if there is going to be an auction. So, but I'm open to doing the auction later in the day. Are you thinking of having a hearing on the 6th?
Is that correct? In the morning. We're open, like starting at 9, see if we can get it resolved.
All right, Your Honor, I think that would be fine, and I think what we can do is we can move the auction to the 7th.
Yeah, or you could do it at 10. Or 10:30 or something. I was thinking do it in the morning. You can start your auction later that morning. I hope I can rule. I will endeavor to give you a ruling on the bench.
Oh, I see. You're talking about just coming in for argument on the 6th.
Right, and then be ruling from the bench. I know it's possible that if I rule adversely to you, then everyone's there for an auction that doesn't happen, or not. Maybe folks still want to go forward. I know I've read your deal. It is clearly, you know, you're selling what you got and nothing more, and as long as the buyer's comfortable. But I assume the buyer does want the goodwill that you've discussed. But let me turn to the other folks who might be involved in this. What I'm thinking is the trustee will file his opening brief, bless you, by March 20. The response would be due, yes, you're getting 11 days, so March 1, and I guess, yes, Ms. Cal, I'm going to give you my
March 20, and I was saying February 20.
Sorry, February 20. Thank you. February 20. I'm mixing months here. February 20, response would be, opposition would be due March 1. Any reply due by noon on March 5 with the hearing on March 6th at 9 a.m. Who on the right, my right side of the room, is there anyone that has any concerns with that proposal? This is just on the legal issue of whether the trustee can sell the dies, assuming the trustee owns it. This is it. Can the trustee sell it with the intellectual property that's attached to it? That's the limited legal issue.
Is this just for the medallic art sale?
No, for everything. Let's just get it all. Let's get it all.
What's the hearing date again?
March 6 at 9 a.m. Does anyone have any concerns with those dates, that timing? Hearing none. All right. So, so to recap, on the issue of whether the trustee can sell the dies under 363F will be heard on March 6th at 9 a.m. Trustee's opening brief can be, you can make it 24 pages. That's due on February 20 by 5 p.m. Any responses need to be filed by March 1 at 5 p.m. And again, anyone can file a 24-page motion. This is dispositive, I gather. And Mr. Guerin, I don't know how many responses you're going to get, so I'm not going to limit you on the reply brief. I'm hoping that maybe the defendants can work together and cut down on the briefing. That would certainly make it easier for everybody, but I'm not going to require that.
So these are just legal issues?
These are just purely the legal issues.
So you're not looking for declarations?
I'm not going to preclude them if they're helpful for me to understand. I don't think I'm going to need them, but I'm not going to say no. But the issue is, this is assuming the estate owns the dies, which I've not yet reached. I think that's a factual issue. But if the estate owns them, there's no dispute that there's intellectual property on the dies that doesn't belong to the estate. Trustee concedes that. Can the trustee sell it? Whether it's free and clear or there's some other issue, whether it's a catapult issue, and Boy Scouts I think raised that, you may have as well, Mr. High. You know, whether there are other intellectual, I heard work for hire. I mean, I there are all sorts of IP issues that may be implicated by what the trustee is seeking to do. And since no one's really fully briefed, this has kind of come up in reply, I think we need to get a full vetting of the legal issues. I'm going to do my best to rule from the bench on March 6th at 9 o'clock. Okay?
So are you limiting it to the second part of the issue then?
Correct.
Whether they can sell, whether the trustee can sell,
can even sell it.
Intellectual property. So that's the...
No. The trustee is not selling the intellectual property. Can the trustee sell the die that has intellectual property on it?
So this is not a sale free and clear then? That is a hypothetical.
That's what it would be. That's what the trustee is proposing to do, is to sell it.
Sell it free and clear of our intellectual property interests?
Sell it free and clear of, yes, that's my understanding. That's what the trustee is trying to do. Yeah.
What happens to our intellectual property interests then?
They're still yours.
To sale?
They're still yours.
Then they're not selling it free and clear of those, are they? If they sell it free and clear, then the buyer can go out and do business with anybody. Well, there's no intellectual property.
That's the issue I raised. Hold on, Mr. That's the issue I raised, Mr. Hyatt, and that concerns me.
Concerns me.
Well, okay. And so you're going to tell me why legally I can't do that. Mr. Guerin says it's not the court's concern because the court is supposed to protect the creditors of this estate and shouldn't be concerned that someone may use your client's intellectual property. I don't think I agree with that, but that's the argument that's been made, and I'm going to let the parties fully brief that. But you've identified a concern that I've had. I thought I've said it a couple of times.
Well, I heard that, but the question is whether it's sold free and clear or subject to the rights that we have. It's like selling a piece of real estate. You can sell it free and clear of the secured client.
Or not.
You can sell it.
That's right.
Is the hypothetical, since this isn't even before the court for Northwest Territorial Mint.
Well, it's going to be, though, and I want to get it resolved.
I understand that. Yeah. But the hypothetical that we're briefing is a sale free and clear of our...
Let me just be clear. The trustee is going to file a motion or file opening brief. It's going to say why you can sell this property, whether it's free and clear or subject to. We're going to let the trustee make the argument, one or both, or something else. Trustee is going to tell me and tell you why He thinks he can sell these, if he owns them, we're gonna do the second part first. If he would own them, why he can sell them to Metalcraft or anybody else. And he's gonna address those concerns that you've raised, because I've raised them, whether it's subject to or free and clear of, that's gonna be his argument to make. All right, you're gonna get to respond, and then I'm gonna rule on it. And if I rule in the trustee's favor, then we're gonna do part one second, which is, okay, does the trustee in fact own it? And that's probably an evidentiary hearing. Maybe the trustee works something out with folks in the interim. We'll see. Okay? All right. Those are valid questions. Oh, you're gonna, Mr. Guerin, you gotta include Ms. Carey in all this as well, because she has asserted, she has, are your dyes from the metallic side or the mint side, Ms. Carey?
They're from the mint.
All right, the record said, Ms. Carey said the mint, okay.
But my question is...
You need to come up, Ms. Carey. I'm sorry, but we, like I said, we need, and you know, you could grab a chair and sit in one of the chairs if you want, so I don't have to keep walking back and forth, but... What's your concern?
There was an assertion that some of the dyes have already been given back. Might that be a precedent?
It might be, but that's for the issue of the other day. That's for the next time around when I decide what the ownership is. That, yes, that would be, but not for regards to this current issue that's going to be briefed and heard on March 6th. That's a different issue.
And that might be one reason why I'd like to know about the dyes that were given back, especially when I was told that none of them were given back.
I understand. That's an issue for another day.
Okay, and I didn't get a clear answer. Maybe I didn't understand. Will I be able to see the inventory to see if my metals
that's
were
not,
in
there? I'm not ruling on that today. You'll have to talk to Mr. Calvert, but I'm not ruling that. I'm not going to say that anyone can go look at the inventory. That's not a request that's before me, and not one I'm likely to grant. You're going to need to work with Mr. Calvert. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
We can talk about it after the hearing, Ms. Carey, but I think we've already told you there really isn't any inventory to look at.
Okay, you can take that conversation offline, Mr. Guerin and Ms. Carey.
Your Honor, may I?
Yes, Mr. Powers.
Just one, because this isn't really directly our issue, although there's been a lot of litigation, and I think the less litigation, the better. But my clients... I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My client believes that there is a list in the computer, in the company's computers, of all dyes sold in the last 10 years with the customer information attached. So we have a notice question to deal with, I think.
That's if the trustee will look for that and report on that. So that takes us to the other issue. We've dealt with the people who are in the room. What do we do with the people that aren't in the room or don't know about this? And my thought is, Mr. Guerin, is that you and Mr. Calvert need to do your best to try to look for this list that supposedly is on the computer and do whatever you can to notify folks that who may claim an ownership of a tool or a coining die and send a notice to those customers and give the customer 21 days to object of the mailing of the notice. And then anyone who objects will need to deal with it. Now, I suppose if I rule adverse to the trustee on March 6th, maybe this is all academic, right? Maybe you don't make...
I think if you tell us that the intellectual property is intrinsic and we can't sell free and clear out of whatever intellectual property rights these customers have, regardless of whether we own the dyes, I think that disposes of it.
I think it does.
But you're right. I am going to tell you, I think this is a very difficult chore, right, to go and identify potentially thousands of customers and send a mailing out to each one of them.
Right.
I mean, practically, I don't know how we're going to do that. We have a very limited staff now. We've cut back tremendously on what's there. This could take us, I don't know how many days and weeks of work to do this, right? Uh, I, I, I do come back to you. I mean, I think that addressing the issue with the people who are here who have raised objections, and then I think what we should do is talk to the buyer about this issue and determine whether, I think they do understand they're not getting a warranty and they're only getting what the company owns. And I think you can clear things up with a ruling in this case with the people who have expressed an interest.
Right.
But those other parties that haven't appeared and we haven't, you know, specifically bound them, I think they still have their due process arguments and they can raise them with the buyer.
Right, but I appreciate the cost and the challenge. That doesn't mean that the company still owns the die. That's the problem. Everything you've said may be true, but that doesn't mean as a matter of law, and I think somebody raised, maybe it was Ms. Kaplan, the fact that Medallic sold them, the Hoff's prior company sold the Medallic Arts to Mr. Hoff doesn't mean Medallic owned them either. Medallic sold whatever it sold. It may have said Medallic Limited back then that it owns them, but that's not dispositive either, I don't think. So we can do it one of two ways. I'm in the interest of time, you can send the notice out now. I suppose we can wait and see what happens on March 6th, and if I rule in your favor or if we figure out some workaround, then we can address the due process issue at that time. But I guess I'm not going to make a final decision, but at least what I'm thinking is if we're going to go forward, we need to figure out some way of trying to notify as many people as we can. You go look for that list that Mr. Hansen says is on the computer, and let me know if you find it. I kind of leave it up to you, but people are going to need 3 weeks' notice to object or make a claim, and I don't know how you do it. You publish. I'm loath to require the estate to start publishing in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. That's how you would do it in a big case, but it's not, and we're not going to, I think, do that here.
I understand the court's concern.
Yeah.
And maybe we could come back. I think we're going to be back in front of you on the 23rd.
Yes, come back on the 23rd. Think about all this.
Try to give you a proposal for how we would.
Let's do it that way. But for now, at least we'll start moving toward a resolution on the legal issue of whether the trustee can even sell these tools and dies, given the IP on them, regardless of whether or not we know the owner of the IP.
Your Honor, with respect to the notice due process issue, one way to reach more customers might be to have the trustee put up on their website a notice that if you think that you own this, that then you have to submit your contact information to the trustee.
That's a good idea. That would be one way to get notice out to at least some folks, at least out into the community,
right,
of folks who might be involved in this industry. I won't require that, but that's one approach. I'll just wait to hear on the 23rd. On the 23rd, we're going to be taking up the borrowing motion, the bid procedures, breakup fee. Two more things. No one addressed this. But the court will. There were a number of objections, responses filed by unsecured creditors. And I want to put their names in the record. And that was Tracy Ralph, Tim Tate, Alex McQuinn, Tom Sortom, R.A. Galfin Jr., George Cooper, Lane Marmion, Catherine Faw, Andres Jacob, Mark Weisbaum, and Rita Pelk. All of them filed responses. And essentially, the response is they are frustrated and unhappy that the assets are being sold and their claims aren't being paid. I think a lot of folks in this room share that frustration. And while their frustrations are valid, that's not a basis to oppose the sale at this point. The trustee has a duty to liquidate estate assets and distribute the proceeds in accordance with the code. It looks like in this case that the only situation
will result in payments to administrative costs. Parties have noted that the legal fees incurred are substantial. I will remind folks that those fees have only been incurred. They've not yet been approved or paid at this point. In addition to the professional fees who voluntarily took on the engagement knowing they may not be paid, now there may be other parties who provided the benefit to the debtor during the case, which include landlords and the former employees, who at least one is on embarking on a WARN Act claim, who may have administrative expense claims. So the trustee does have a duty to try to sell the assets for the highest and best price, to at least pay the administrative expense claims in full, or at least as much as possible. Finally, to the issues raised by Mrs. Pell and Mr. William Hansen, I acknowledge their concerns, and they are serious allegations, and I want you, Mrs. Pell and Mr. Hansen, William Hansen, and others to recognize that. I don't see them as a basis for opposing the sale, either the auction sale or any other sale that is to be heard in the near future. Mrs. Pell, to the extent you're asking the court to void your joint defense agreement or your confidentiality agreement, I forget the exact name of it, but either to asking me to void it or to grant you relief from it, that's an agreement between parties, and courts can't generally just void agreements without there being, at the very least, a motion, if not some sort of lawsuit alleging breach or alleging a basis for being relieved from your duties. And so I can't grant you relief today based upon your oral request or even upon your letter in the absence of some sort of motion, at the very least, if not a lawsuit, for either breach of that agreement by someone or your belief that you should be relieved from following through to it. You should talk to Mr. Northrup. I highly encourage you, if there's something that needs, that you want to be disclosed, talk to Mr. Northrup. I don't see anyone here from the U.S. Trustee's office. I was going to ask them if, clearly they're aware of what's been said since the letters are on the docket. And the U.S. Trustee's office may take a look into it.
Your Honor, may
yes.
I say a few words? On the issue of the documents that I understand your position completely, but first let me say that. And I really wasn't expecting that you would void the confidentiality agreement. I do bring to the attention, though, that it is very difficult for unsecured creditor committee members to actually fulfill their role of representing the creditors if, in fact, then they're muzzled. So it's a contradictory setup. Having said that, I would like to say that I wanted permission to present some materials essentially to the court for evaluation and determination. But the second request, which required the tracking of these inventory sheets, really doesn't pertain to me. It's not something that I have a stake in. I felt it part of my obligation as a member of the committee. And I can easily let go of that, although I take my charge and responsibilities very intensely. I've been a very hardworking member of the committee. I think I can safely say that the committee tried, but it has been blocked in operating through the norms of what are supposed to be the procedures.
All right. Thank you.
Therefore, it is, I think, useless for me to try to put that through the regular protocol. On the first item, which
Ms. Pell, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I've heard argument from everybody. I've made my ruling now. Let me just say once again, the allegations you've made, both in writing and today, I take very seriously. I don't think today, though, is the day to address them. I think someone stated, and I think I agree, that it's probably more appropriate to raise these at the time that there are applications filed by professionals for compensation, or in the connection with some other action that directly relates to the administration or questions of the administration of this case. But today, we've talked about a lot, but it's really related to whether or not the trustee should be allowed to move forward to sell certain assets. And again, while your allegations are serious and will be taken seriously, I don't see them going to an argument against selling the assets. Now, maybe you've got some information that relates to the value. If you think that the trustee is not getting the right value, you should tell the court that at the appropriate time. But today is not that day. It'll be at the time when I'm seeking to actually approve the sale and the sale price. If you think that there's something wrong with the sale or the sale price, you should definitely raise that. All right?
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I appreciate your time. I appreciate everyone's time this morning who have been here. I don't think I have anything further. We will, but what we'll do is we'll do an order that includes the deadline for filing the complaint to assert that the estate does not own the Medallic assets. That order will also include the briefing schedule on the whether the trustee may sell the assets. I don't think I need anything else in that order at the moment. Does anyone think otherwise?
Are you just going to continue the auction hearing by order?
Yes. This is going to be an order on the sale, on the auction motion, and first item in the order will be, it's continued to 223. I'll put in the requirement to file any complaint by 222 with respect to the ownership of the Medallic assets. And to be clear, I would only decide what's in or what's out. If I decide that it's out, I'm not going to decide who owns it, whether it's Mr. Hansen or Mr. Bressler or Malp. I would only decide that it's not in the estate. But the third item in that order would be the briefing schedule. I think that's all I need. But so everyone knows, everyone's got the dates on their calendars.
Your Honor, would you consider picking an evidentiary hearing date on the ownership issues just for the MAC LLC assets in March, preferably?
Sure.
So that if we prevail on the 6th and we're still moving forward, we can get those factual issues on the table as well.
Right. And I wonder for something. I guess also taking a step back in this order, you're going to, on the 23rd, present a plan for getting notice. Potential customer. I'm not going to put that in the order, but I'm going to be looking for that. All right, I'm going to be looking for that because, again, we'll have an evidentiary hearing only with respect to the four people we know, but there may be others. That's kind of the problem, and I don't know how to wrestle with that today. I mean, the fact that it's costly to try to give them notice doesn't mean they're not entitled to it. It's like, you know, future tort victims. You don't know who they are, but you can't just discharge their claims. You got to make some effort to notify them.
Okay, Your Honor. So it sounds like
But yes, we could, to answer your question, I can get a date. We can get a date set on the calendar, and that's probably a good idea, because we don't have dates.
I'm thinking, you know, late March, or maybe, I guess, early April for that event, just to pick a date and have it set up there. But I think we're going to have to come back to you on the 23rd and talk about notice. You're talking about 21 days notice to people who are expressing an interest.
Well, to give them some opportunity to object, because I'm assuming, you know, you're going to have to mail it out, and people are going to get the mail. It's going to take 3 days. They're going to look at this and go, what is this? And they're going to want to talk to someone. I want to give them some time. It's certainly not going to be 7 days. I may be able to be talked out of 21, but it's usually some multiple of seven. So 14 is the only other one. But or maybe your buyer doesn't care. Maybe your buyer thinks they'll, you know, I'm okay with it. I mean, this happened with Tombow. I mean, I went back and looked at the order. I preserved Mr. Hansen's right to claim that he owned the assets. He didn't do anything with it. This is why I'm not going to let him put a cloud over this sale. That's why I'm forcing him to file a lawsuit this time. But there was a cloud over that sale, but the buyer went ahead anyway. I just don't want a cloud. But at least with respect to the metallic assets, but with respect to the dyes, there just may not be a way around that, and this may be something that everyone has to live with.
All right, we'll have a conversation with the buyer, and we can sort it out that way.
Okay. But if we want to just have a placeholder date, we can. You think in the end of March?
I think so.
Oh, really? Oh, boy. What do we have the following week? I'm just sorry. I didn't mean to be. This is like in between two calendars will be. Do we have anything the following week? So, okay. So this would again, for the moment, just be the medallic folks, and the only one here representing someone with a medallic die is you, Ms. Kaplan. Correct.
Right.
Are you here the 22nd or the 30th of March?
Yes, I do leave on April 4th.
Okay. So I want to be before that. The 22nd or the 30th, Mr. Guerin, which one would you like? The 14th may be too early.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 22nd, Your Honor.
All right. 22nd.
Actually, I'll take the 30th. And only because I think. Your determination on the 6th makes the difference one way or the other. Before we start ramping up for a trial, I think we ought to have some.
Well, not only that, I mean, I don't know what kind of discovery you're going to need. I mean, I want to move this quickly, but. Yet, there's almost certainly going to be some discovery. I mean, this seems pretty witness heavy.
Yeah, that's discovery. So. Your Honor, I guess. Just talking about it, I think I'm going to, maybe we should set that discussion over on setting the trial date until the 23rd as well.
I did.
We're maybe not there yet, so I brought it up.
No, that's okay. Everyone knows that I set trials way out in the future, but we always keep some dates. We always have dates open, largely because people settle. So we do have some dates open in March, probably, though April is probably pretty tight because I'm gone part of it. So April, once we get out of March, we're looking at late April, maybe not. Very limited days in April. Very limited days in April. So, it's probably best just to revisit this on the 23rd, all these issues. And I know you guys will work something out. Maybe you can talk to Ms. Carmody. Maybe there's some solution.
I guess, but based on what you said about April, I think it would be best for if we could reserve the 30th date, right? Because I don't want that to go away and us to be in May.
I'm sorry?
I would not want to defer into May.
You want to pick a date in May?
No, I'm saying that since you don't have dates in April, I don't want it to kick over into May, and so I'd rather take the 30th.
Let's hold the 30th. We will hold March 30 all day for an evidentiary hearing. Whether this issue or anything else, we'll just hold that. That's not a license to file motions for the 30th, people. We're going to hold that, but for an evidentiary hearing. Okay. Anything further from anyone? All right.
thank you all very much. I guess.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Everyone have a lunch and have a nice weekend. I'll be at recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.